right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. I am your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here, Studio D, overlooking beautiful downtown Chicago. And we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Here, man, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. That's one artist, three songs, Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. Coming up in just a few minutes, our good friend, singer-songwriter Noah Gabriel is going to be here. He's going to play some songs for us live, and he's got a bunch of gigs coming up, including the new Americana Songwriter Revival, which is taking place on November 16th at Pheasant Run. And you can check out noahgabriel.com. We're very excited to have Noah back in studio. It's always fun to talk to him and hear his music. He's terrific. So that's coming up. We are also going to be talking about the first roles of actors and actresses before they became big stars. Some of them are hilarious. I mean, some of the first roles that the actors and actresses are having, we'll talk about that. And the NBA kicked off, and the Bulls season is kicks off tonight. And so we're going to give you how the NBA teams got their names and the stories behind that and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you want to jump in at any time, and also for your Triple Play Thursday requests. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us right now and join the several thousand of friends who are on our Facebook page and like us. So it's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Also, you should subscribe to our podcasts. If you can't listen live between 1 and 5 a.m., you can listen at your leisure, bro. And every second of every show is podcast. And you subscribe, go to iTunes or where you get your podcasts. It's free. And it will automatically be sent to your device. And again, you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there's all that cool stuff. And that's what's coming up on this Thursday morning. And let me say hello to my great producer, Dan Shagrew. Hello, Dan.
Howdy, Nick.
How are you?
Good, man. How about yourself?
I'm okay. I'm all right. I'm excited for the Hawks to come back. But I'm going to miss the game because I'm you know, I normally don't go to a lot of the evening movie screenings because that's like prime nap time for me usually.
Right, yeah.
They're screening Suspiria tonight. So, but just so you know, Dan, I know it's a Friday morning show. I might be loopy right around.
Oh, good times.
Right around 3-4 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to be loopy because I'm sacrificing some sleep so that I can see Suspiria. I'm so mixed on this one because I hear it's great. But Suspiria, the original Suspiria, is one of my favorite movies of all time and one of my favorite horror movies, and to me, the scariest movie I've ever seen. And it's such a distinctive and original movie that there's no reason to remake it. But from what I understand, the director didn't do a straight remake of it. He changed the style of it, and he wanted to make a movie in the spirit of how Suspiria made him feel when he watched it.
Oh, that's cool.
And The director is Luda Guadagnino, who last year did a completely different movie called Call Me By Your Name. He's an interesting director, I got to say. By all accounts, the movie's insane. And that it is, I don't know. Anyway, so I'm going to see it. And it's 2.5 hours long. That's an hour longer than the original. I have no idea what's happening. I've hated the idea for, you know, ever since they said they were going to remake Suspiria. I thought it was the worst idea ever. But, you know, even Suspiria fans of the original are like, no, this is great. It's weird. It's bloody. It's really scary and strange. And Jessica Harper's in it and has done a bunch of press for it and it loves it. And Jessica Harper, by the way, if you don't know, she was the lead in the original Suspiria. I have not heard from Dario Argento, the guy who created and directed the original Suspiria, but if I get the word that he approves, then okay. But I'm sure. I'm seeing it tonight, so I don't. that's I'm gonna miss the Hawks. Yes, but I'm gonna see Suspiria, so I'll let you know how it is. I can't give you a full review because there's the full on embargo that we can't really talk about. I can hint at how I felt about it, and I'll tell you guys tomorrow morning on the show. So that's my evening tonight.
Right on.
All right. In the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
If we see popcorn being thrown in the theater while you're there, we'll assume the Blackhawks went into overtime.
Well, yeah. Well, that might be
well
the only
played, Vic. Well
that,
played.
That might be the only way that right, I get. To, that might be the only way that I get to see part of the game, because I'll be getting out of the movie around.
Now you're hoping they go into OT.
Yeah,
no,
this
we
is,
would never hope that.
No, but I mean, I'm getting out of the movie around 9:30 because it starts at 7. I'll be getting out around 9:30 or
that's
so.
Right.
And
the way this season's going, you'll probably catch some Blackhawks tonight.
I would hope so, and I hope they win. Obviously,
yeah,
but I really did want to watch the games because I just want to see Crow in the
right.
You know, in the net. But we'll see what happens. How you doing, Vic? You good?
Yep, doing well, sir.
All right, man. It's Thursday morning. Vic is in the newsroom, and Dan is producing, and that's what's happening on the show. And I'll let you guys know what's going on with Suspiria. And it's just so weird, Dan, that I never would have thought of this 40 years ago and 41 years ago, that in 2018, within a two-day span, I will see Suspiria and Halloween.
Yeah.
Two of my favorite horror movies of all time. Two of the, I mean, seriously, one and two, like right up there. And there are new versions of them that we're playing now. 40 years ago, you flash back to my 13-year-old self thinking, 40 years from now, I'm going to be seeing Suspiria on a Thursday night and Halloween on a Saturday afternoon. What? It's weird times we live in, man. And A Star Is Born from 1976.
Oh, yeah.
That's out now, too. I'm in my teen years here now. It's just weird. Oh, man. So, by the way, we're going to take a break here when we come back. Noah Gabriel's going to join us, and his lovely wife, Rachel, is with him. They recently just had a baby. So that's another thing that we get to talk about. And they have the grandparents watching the baby right now. And Dan, as you know, every once in a while, you need to take a break and maybe get out.
Yes.
So that's what they've done.
Good call.
That's what they've done. All right, we're going to take a break. Noah Gabriel will be joining us live in studio. And he's in the PPC paint. PPG, sorry, the PPG paint green room. And that's where he is right now. We're picking him up from there. And so there he is in the PPG paint green room. So, all right, let's take a break here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. That music that you hear is In the Stars Requiem from Noah Gabriel's 2017 album, Dead Reckoning. And Noah's been on. This is the fourth time that you've been on the show. Fourth time. That's because I like you, man.
I was going to say, not many people bring me back four times.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing good.
Good, good. Good to see you. Congratulations to you and your lovely wife.
Thank you very much.
What is your boy's name?
Jude Cash.
Jude Cash.
Yeah.
What? Okay. Explain.
Obviously, Jude Beatles.
Yep.
And Cash, Johnny Cash.
That's beautiful, man.
Yeah.
The kid's going to grow up to be a musician. No kid. You've already predetermined that with
you
the
gotta
name.
You got
to
see man. The mitts. He's got huge hands.
Does he really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's awesome.
I've seen a lot of pictures. You've been posting a lot of really cool pictures.
Oh, tons.
He's adorable.
Man. Yes, he is.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
To both of you, because Rachel's in the studio hanging out with us, too. It's been a busy time for you then, huh?
Yeah, very, very busy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so have you been recording at all?
You know, I have. I forgot, but I've released another album since I've seen you, which I should have brought, and I failed. But yeah, I'm in the middle of recording two albums right now, and doing a little YouTube thing where I'm recording a song a week that I've they've been sitting in a pile. So yeah, I'm doing a bunch.
Well, let's talk about the album that you released then. What's it called? Talk a little bit about it.
It's called So It Goes.
Mm-hmm.
I released it back in March, I believe.
Yeah, the last time you were here was January.
Yeah,
was the last
yeah.
time you were with us, yeah.
I recorded it with my buddy Dave Ramon, who came on probably like two, three times
sure.
ago with me.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it, you know, just another, it was a weird album. We got a little weightsy with some of the production and stuff like that, because we're both Tom Waits fans, so a lot of weird sounds going on and stuff like that, but some really beautiful ballads and you know... another singer-songwriter type album.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, tell everybody about your background. I mean, you know, you've been on the show and I know it, but give everybody how you got started in music and all that.
I got started playing around 12. Really dug in then, and you know, I grew up like most kids with an electric guitar, wanting to be Jimi Hendrix and Stevie Ray Vaughan, and realized that that's not going to get me everywhere I want to be. You know, I started writing stuff when I was probably a sophomore in high school, and I've leaned more towards the writing side of things than the shredding side of things.
Right.
These days.
Right.
So yeah, I'm on album number 11, and working on 12 and 13, and got a bunch more written. Just a matter of time.
So you write all the time?
I try to, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's my exercise. You know, that's how I keep myself on point and try and push to learn new things is, you know, by writing.
Mm-hmm. And do you like to, when you play out gigs and you do the solo acoustic stuff, do you enjoy that?
I do. It all depends. I mean, you know, everyone talks about it, but, you know, for every 10 gigs, there's, you know, 3 gigs that are, you know, really enjoyable, and the others, you know, I'm background noise, you know. It all depends, you know. I love doing the listening room thing. I've been doing a bunch of those where I, you know, show up and people are there to see me
right.
and hear me.
Right.
And it's pretty awesome, you know. When you get in a room where people are actually tuned in and you know, hanging on your every word, it's weird, and it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, where tell everybody where you were from.
I'm from Aurora,
yeah,
Illinois.
Aurora,
yeah.
Illinois.
Yeah,
we were talking about Aurora, Dan. We were talking about a pizza place in Aurora last night.
Yeah.
Oh,
man, I can't
what,
remember the
Ock
name.
Ock and Lou's, Luigi's.
No, what was the first one?
Ock and Lou's.
That's it.
Oh yeah,
that's it. Because we were talking about you know, great pizza in
oh,
the city,
yeah.
which is a conversation that you could spend 5 hours on in this city talking
yeah.
about pizza. But that a person called in and said that was the best.
It it's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you did that was your go-to
place? I grew
place?
Up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We still hit it up when we can.
Yeah.
It's like you go there on a Friday night and there is a line of people out the door.
Wow.
Just waiting to pick up their pizza or place their order. You know, I mean,
this person was very enthusiastic about the place.
Oh, yeah. No, it's good stuff.
Yeah.
But it's funny because I told my buddy Greg, he's another songwriter, he's from Georgia, about it. Told him it's like the best pizza ever. He tried it, and like he has not let it go. He hated it. He's like ragged on me ever since.
And
he's
where's
like,
he from, Georgia?
He's from Georgia.
What does he know about pizza?
Nothing. Go eat a peach, right?
What kind of pizza can you get in Georgia?
Yeah.
Come on, man.
I don't know. If it's like the pizza you get in Austin, Texas, it ain't pizza.
You spent some time in Austin.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. You it's a great town, right?
It's a great town.
What do you do when you go down there?
You know what? When we get down there to hang out, you know, Sixth Street has turned into like the Broadway of Austin. So you hear nothing but cover bands, and you know the same tunes coming out of every other bar and stuff like that. But the cool thing is the East Side, which used to be a little run down. That's where we were living when we were down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's flipped like 180, and there's tons of cool spots over there, and you know, it's
Well, I mean, over the years, Austin has just exploded,
it's
man.
Always changing.
How long have you been? How long did you live there?
We lived there for only like a year, but I've been going down there for like the past like probably 12 years on and off, and every time I go down, it's completely different. I mean, we went back less than a year after we moved and didn't recognize it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
And that just That's how it is down there.
It's also kind of happening everywhere because there are, you know, and I remember, you know, like 15 years ago what Logan Square was like.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And now you go to Logan Square and it's like the hottest, it's like the, you know, there's all these incredible restaurants and bars. And,
yeah.
You know, I remember when the Logan Theater was run down and mm-hmm. it was a hole and now it's like this really, you know, fancy schmancy place. Yeah. But that's happening all over the place.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of gentrification stuff here in the city is moving further. It just keeps moving further west.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like I live in Old Irving Park.
Okay.
And you know, it's there's stuff popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
But Austin is one of those cities that, you know, I haven't been there in years.
Yeah.
I've only been there once.
Okay.
And I loved it when I was there.
Yeah.
It was just it's really cool. And you know, the South by Southwest fest and the music fest. Did you ever play that?
I played it a couple times.
Yeah.
That's not even, you know, that's I want to say it's a shadow of what it was. But, I mean, it's bigger than it's ever been.
Yeah.
But, like, it used to be, like, just, like, localized, like, right there on 6th Street. Like, the first time I went there, it was just a sea of people, and you could walk to every venue. And I was walking down the street, and I thought people were staring at me. I'm like, what's going on? I finally turn around, and Pete Townshend was walking right behind me.
Oh,
you know, right through the middle of 6th Street, because they had, like, the big press booth in the center of everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, all the big, like, you know, MTV when they still did music and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they're all there, and he was walking to do an interview.
Pete
and it was
Townsend just
like,
walking down the street.
Yeah, just wild.
Yeah. No, but it's you know, I have a colleague here on the show who reviews movies with me. His name is Eric Childress, and he goes to all the film festivals every year and then gives us live reviews, you know, of the movies that he's seen. And he described how, you know, because he's been going to the South by Southwest for many years.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just how crazy it is now.
Oh, yeah.
It's completely crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it's a good town, man.
Oh, it's awesome.
And you get down there, you play, and have you recorded down there?
No. I mean, I recorded an album down there when we were living.
When you were living
there. I recorded it, you know, by myself, you
right.
know, in our condo, you know.
Right.
All by my lonesome.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, Noah Gabriel is with us. Hang out, okay?
All right.
He's going to join us. We're going to talk about this new Americana songwriter revival. We got to talk about that, man, because that sounds amazing, and that's going to be cool. You got a couple of other gigs and more, and we're going to hear some live music from Noah. So hang out. We're going to take a break. We got the news coming up next, and then more with Noah Gabriel right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man. Get your requests in now at 312-981-7200. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. What you just heard there was Noah Gabriel, and that song is Damage. And Noah's here, live in studio for the fourth time.
Hey, hey.
How are you, man?
Doing good.
Good, 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 good. Tell me about that song.
That song... was a song I wrote for my uncle who passed away, oh man, a year and a half ago now. That whole album was written for and about family and stuff, and just about dealing with terminal illness and oncoming death and stuff like that.
It's a great album, man.
Thank you very
much.
And
you gave me a copy on vinyl.
Yeah.
And I do. We mentioned before the artwork. Cover art is extraordinary.
Yeah,
just really beautiful. But so that song is. It is like a concept album, kind of, right?
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, the first side is kind of from the angle of someone who is sick and passing away. That song in particular, my uncle had three kids and. I was just trying to think of, you know, how what is he thinking about them? Because I know everyone who goes through that stuff, they tend to, you know, have this outward look. You know, a lot of them aren't worrying about themselves so much as, you know, if they have kids, they're like, oh, my God, you know, how are they going to be? You know, how can I leave them? And it was kind of from that angle, thinking about that and just kind of, you know, just the thought of any parent saying, like, you know, don't dwell on this, you know, let's just enjoy what we have and, you know, move on.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, it's a beautiful album, man.
Thank you.
Really, really good. And I'm a big fan of yours in general, though, man. I think you're
Thank
great.
You.
Let's talk a little bit about the, you know, you say you write a lot. And how does that work out? Do you have your guitar with you all the time? Do you just how do you do that?
Yeah, I do. I have I have like three guitars that kind of live around me, you know, and they rotate depending on what mood I'm in. Lately, it's been this guy here. This is my newest. It's a 1936 National Resonator, which
it's a beautiful guitar.
It is. It's got some. Got some dings. It's definitely lived a life.
Where'd you get it?
My guitar tech, Kramer Guitar Works in Aurora. It had been hanging on his wall for years, and one day I walked in and finally took notice, and I picked it up. And one of my favorite songwriters and guitar players is Chris Whitley. And as soon as I picked this up and started, you know, messing around with it, like I knew that sound. And it turns out Chris Whitley played the same exact guitar, just 1 year off.
Wow.
So, like, my ear was pretty, you know, correct as to, like, you know, oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, so I have guitars sitting around me all the time, and, you know, I sit on the couch, you know, we'll have TV on, and, you know, if I'm not holding Jude, I'm holding my guitar, and,
right.
You know, yeah.
So there you go, and you write all the time, yeah.
I try to, yeah, yeah. I'm definitely trying to learn new avenues to that these days, but yeah, that's how I exercise my mind.
And so let's talk a little bit. You have some other gigs coming up at Kiss the Sky. You have an acoustic thing. It's a Saturday morning cafe.
Yep,
and that's this Saturday.
That is this Saturday
in Batavia from 10:30 a.m. to noon,
mm-hmm.
And then at Vintage 53 at the city. You're working overtime that day.
Oh yeah,
and then you're at 8 o'clock. You're at Vintage 53 at in St. Charles.
Yeah, yeah,
and people can see you there. And then at the Finery on Halloween.
On Halloween, yeah. Yes.
And that's with you and Dave.
Yes.
All right, and that's in St. Charles as well. So, but the big thing that we want to talk about here is this new Americana songwriter revival.
Yes.
Tell me all about that.
You know what? We were approached by Heather Humphrey from Shadowfields with the idea, and she was just trying to put together a really cool night of music. And Pheasant Run has this great stage, great theater, and everything. And they're trying to get more local and touring acts through there.
Mm-hmm.
They got the Zanies over there and stuff
right.
like that. So, I mean, it is a bit of a destination spot.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she put together a great bill. So Shadowfields, Diving Bell, November 16th at Pheasant Run. And, it's going to be a cool night.
And the idea is to celebrate songwriting, Americana songwriting.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, to me, you know, Americana encompasses so much. I mean, that's, you know, I like that genre because I hate genres.
Right. Right.
And to me, Americana, you know, is basically at folk, blues, rock, you know, soul, a little jazz. I mean, you know, I look at artists like Lucinda Williams and Ryan Adams who are, you know, big Americana stars, and they do anything and everything,
right?
You know,
right? That does encompass a lot of stuff, though.
It does,
yeah.
And I like it. But at the heart of it is just solid songwriting, you know, which in popular music that seems to be not so popular.
I think you're right.
Yeah,
I agree with you on that. You know, it's really amazing because you know I watch SNL every week.
Oh yeah. Man, I watch your reviews of SNL
because
I have a hard time actually watching the show. But
I like an idiot. I'm such a geek. I do like live grades
of each
sketch and of the musical performances. And you know, inevitably when they have like a popular artist as the musical guest, maybe I've heard of them. Most likely, I probably haven't.
Oh, yeah.
But they had Paul Simon on last week.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, I know I sound like an old man, but I was like, see, that's a musical guest.
Oh, yeah.
And
he
just had, like a small string section.
Yeah.
And they were all just, it was you know, there was no electric instruments on the stage at all. And he did one of his solo songs, and then his second performance was Bridge over Troubled Water.
Yeah.
And it made me cry. I was just sitting, I'm like on the couch, like, this is my, it was beautiful. Yeah. It was beautiful. And the week before was Kanye West wearing a MAGA hat.
Yeah.
So I was like, this is so much more, this is so much more my thing.
Well, and it was that guy's the voice of a generation.
Oh, come on, man. Yeah. And he's married to Edie Brickell. Which is still stunning to me.
Yeah.
But no, he sounded great. And you know, he's been on that show a million times.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's got such a rich history with SNL. It was always great to see him come back.
I was hoping he would show up in a turkey costume again.
Yeah. That'd be great. Well, listen, the Pheasant Run Theater is at 4051 Main Street in St. Charles. And it's Friday, November 16th at 7 o'clock. We have a link on our Facebook page for tickets. And that's the New Americana Songwriters Revival. And it's going to be great. We're going to have Shadowfield on the show, right, Dan? Yeah, in a couple of weeks, Shadowfield is going to be here.
I believe someone from Diving Bell, too.
Yeah.
Might be joining them.
Either way, man, we're gonna talk about this and celebrate it. The New Americana Songwriters Revival again, Friday, November 16th. All right, you know, I didn't set up your mic. Can you move that mic towards you?
Yes.
And push it down so that we can mic your guitar. Does it go? Is it going down? Maybe the one in front of you can go down.
Let's try that.
There you go. All right, so you sing into that one.
Okay.
And
I can do that.
Can you do that? Are you all set?
I can do that.
All right. Looks good.
Sure.
Okay. All right, so what are we going to hear? Are you going to do a song for us?
I'm going to do an old song of mine that I just started playing again because I felt like it. It's called Love Won't Leave Me Alone.
All right, here we go. Yeah. This is Noah Gabriel, everybody.
Some miles on these wheels, babe. And gotta break these chains that have captured my soul. And gotta move this dirt from the grave I've made and breathe before I choke. Run, run, run from the city. Thank you.
Dude, you are so good, man.
Just, thank you.
You kill me, man. You're great. You're just great, man. It's so great to see you and listen to your music, dude. I think you're great. That's Noah Gabriel, everybody, and you can see he's got a bunch of gigs coming up. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And the new Americana Songwriter Revival taking place November 16th at Pheasant Run. Noah, hang out, okay?
Sounds good.
All right, we're gonna take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Noah and hear another song as well, right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, and that's Noah Gabriel. Coming up is Steve Grzanich at 5 with the opening bell, and coming up are the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. That's Noah Gabriel, and that's from the latest.
Yes.
And what song was that?
Cold Feet and Dirty Clothes.
Okay. And what's that one, what's that one about?
That one was a song about moving. That was a... That was the first song I wrote when we had moved down to Austin, Texas.
Oh.
So we moved into this condo, and it was a very modern condo. So it was all concrete floors. You know, we were on the third floor of a tin-roofed building. And the first, like, 2 weeks we were there, it rained nonstop, which, you know, doesn't happen all that often down there. But when it happens, like, it really happens.
Yeah.
And the sound of the rain on the roof was like just thunderous, and you know, there was leaks and stuff like that. It was a very nice place, but it was just, you know, it got me homesick real quick.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So that was, you know, was just about my first week in Austin.
Well, there you go. Noah Gabriel is here, and he's got a few gigs coming up, including the New Americana Songwriter Revival taking place on November 16th at Pheasant Run. You can check out noahgabriel.com. It's funny, off the air, we were talking about your wife's delivery.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a pretty interesting. You guys had a big baby.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us, everybody, how big the baby was.
He was about 9 pounds, I think 8 pounds and 13 ounces.
Almost a 9 pound baby.
Yeah. And she,
Rachel, my wife is not big. No,
you know?
She's not.
So,
and I'm looking at her right now and I'm thinking, yeah, no, that's not pleasant.
Yeah.
So, but you were like an almost 10 pound baby, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's all his fault, Rachel. It's all his fault.
I gave her fair warning.
Well, and I'm glad everybody's good, doing well. That's really fantastic. So now you said you're recording two albums now.
Yes.
Where are you doing those?
One of them I'm recording on my own. It's kind of like a return to the Austin-bound thing. I just had a bunch of songs, and I started demoing them out at home, and as I demoed them out, I just kept on adding stuff, and all of a sudden I'm like, wow, these are starting to sound like, you know, actual songs. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, I followed through on it, and it's all over the place. There's some different stuff on there.
Yeah.
And then the other one I'm recording again with my buddy Adam Gardner, who did Dead Reckoning with me.
Mm-hmm.
So and that one's going to be pretty different too. That's going to be another concept album. It's called Present Tense, and it's kind of just about, you know, the current state of things.
Yes. It just writes itself sometimes.
It
man.
Does. Yeah.
Let's talk before we hear another song. You teach guitar at Music Matters School of Music in Batavia.
Yes.
Is that great? Is that fun for you?
It is. You know, I was very apprehensive. I've known the owner of that school for many years now. In fact, he's helped put on some festivals out in the burbs, and he was always bringing my band Noah's Arcade out.
Yeah.
And every year he'd be like, you know, we could use another guitar teacher. And finally, I thought I paint houses with my dad. I've been helping him with the family business for almost 15 years now.
Yeah.
And I know he's nearing retirement. And I thought, you know, I'll pick up some teaching time so I can wean myself out of the painting as he's doing it.
Right.
And I've grown to really like it. I've got a good bunch of students that I enjoy teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it all depends on the students, you know.
Yeah, but you've got good ones.
I do, yeah. Okay.
Music Matters School of Music in Batavia, if people are interested. All right, what song are we going to hear now?
I'm going to do one. It's called Wichita, which I'll be I'm playing with my buddy Ryan Carney. He's a fabulous cellist. We're going to be doing this at the Americana Singer-Songwriter Revival.
Okay.
So.
And it's called Wichita.
Wichita.
Okay. Noah Gabriel.
Sunshine in her eyes, pale blue like the winter skies of Wichita. Rest on these river banks, mama worked and daddy drank for Wichita. Well, the storms of fist in rage, the river rolled, she rode the waves. Oh, mama got to giving up, told daddy she done had enough fun. Daddy tried to make her stay, instead he put her in a grave. And tattoos cover scars on skin, with the iodine ash and the indigo gem. Time and miles in different skies, reflected in a pale blue eyes. Muddied by the Arkansas River, rolling back across the great divide to Wichita. Leadville, Colorado, gold between the California and the two-bit gulch. Near the headwater river's edge, she got herself a job and she got herself a bed. To understand until she met a girl with a delicate hand. And all those years of living rough disappeared with just a touch. Just a touch. Skies over Wichita.
Beautiful, man. Just beautiful.
Thank you.
You're great, man. You're one of my favorite guests that we've ever had as a singer-songwriter, man.
That's extremely kind.
I think you're fantastic, dude.
Thank
I think
you.
You're great. That's Noah Gabriel. The new Americana Songwriter Revival takes place on November 16th at Pheasant Run. Go to noahgabriel.com for more information. Always a pleasure. Anytime, man.
Thank you.
Anytime,
very much.
Come back down.
Thank
Rachel,
you.
Rachel, good to see you, too. All right, we'll take a break. We have the news coming up next. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WG. I don't know why I sounded like Todd Newton there coming back. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Vic, you familiar with Todd Newton?
As soon as you did that, because I heard you talking about him, it yesterday?
Yesterday we were talking about Todd Newton.
As soon as you did that, before you even said anything, I was like, what was that?
What is he doing, man? I got a little Todd Newton every... Hey, everybody. I'm the host of Whammy.
You know what? I didn't recall who he was, and then you mentioned it. I Googled him, and right away,
I
knew exactly what you were talking about.
He's
good at what he does.
He worked on E, did the red carpet and all that kind of stuff, and he's a game show host too, but the reason why he was brought up is because, as we were talking about yesterday, Vic, the Price is Right's coming to town.
Yep.
To the Chicago Theater. You ever watch Price is Right?
Back in the day.
Yeah.
I don't anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that indicates to me, if I'm watching Price is Right, it indicates to me that I need to go to bed. Because that's like right around the time when I should go to sleep.
Right.
But I always try to watch it to see if the yodeling guy falls off the mountain. So, so he's hosting we don't know because they have a rotating group of hosts who do the Price is Right on the road thing. It's at the Chicago Theater.
You think they'll pick someone locally to do the one when they come to Chicago?
I don't know. They should have Dean do it.
That'd be great.
Yeah, Dean Richards, man. He should host the Price is Right. He would probably go, I don't know.
As Billy Joel.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, they certainly fooled a bunch of people on, did you see that footage?
They did.
Yeah. He has a resemblance to Billy Joel. They fooled him. And it was on Man of the People. It was on Thomas Sulo's show, where they pretended that he was Billy Joel, and a bunch of people were taking pictures with Dean and going nuts, thinking it was Billy Joel. This was when Billy Joel played at the... He had that, it was two or three nights at Wrigley. And so they had a limo, and then Dean got out of it, and people were like, oh, my God, it's Billy Joel, which is pretty funny. But, yeah, Dean as Billy Joel hosting the Price is Right. That would be good.
The thing that got me with that segment, special they did, was the wigged Thomas Sulo as a secret bodyguard didn't throw people off.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
It didn't look that natural on purpose, but right. It was great.
No, that was a funny bit. That was really, really funny. And for years, we've talked about how Dean and Billy Joel have a very strong resemblance of to one another. So anyway, but yeah, so Price is Right. It comes to town, and they do play some of the classic games live. And so that's coming to town. That's why Todd Newton is coming in. But there's no reason why, when I said, hey, we're back, that I had to sound like Todd Newton. There was just no purpose for that at all. But we are back, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here. We are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6. And I will be joining Steve Cochran and the gang for my weekly Thursday morning visit at 6:20. And we'll talk about the new movies that are coming out this weekend and some pop culture stuff. And it's always a blast. And I'm always really, really happy to join Steve for my weekly visit on his show. And that'll be at 6:20 this morning. So stay tuned for that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like for talk or text. And your Triple Play Thursday request. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. That'll be coming up, too, so get your requests in now, 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and our best way to stay connected is on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. So welcome back. If you want to jump in, we're going to be talking about first movie roles for some A-list actors. And Vic, I think you're going to be surprised by how terrible some of these first roles were.
One comes to mind.
What's the first?
Oh, I got to think of the name. I want to say it was Tom Cruise's first role. What was that movie he was in? What was his first role, Nick?
His first role, which, by the way, is listed here in this article.
I knew it.
His first role was Endless Love.
Oh. Yeah. No, that's not the one I'm
thinking. Are you thinking of Losing It?
No.
The teen sex comedy? What were you thinking? Were you thinking of Taps? Taps?
I'm going to have... No. Oh, I love that. No, yeah. That wasn't his first role?
No, that was his second.
Okay. Oh, okay. I'm going to have to look up and listen.
Okay. His first was in Endless Love, which was that ridiculous movie from 1981. And that was his first movie. And it starred Martin Hewitt, who was supposed to be the next big thing. He was the male lead. And it was Martin Hewitt and Brooke Shields. And, of course, the only thing that people remember about Endless Love is the song Endless Love. That's the only thing that people remember, because the movie was terrible. The movie was just awful. But here's what they say. It didn't take long for Tom Cruise to become Tom Cruise. He had his first bit role in Endless Love as Billy, a friend to the main character. And in the same year, he had more substantial role in Taps. So the same year, he did Endless Love first and then Taps after that. And then 2 years later, Cruise was in The Outsiders, and then later that year, Risky Business. And that's when he became an acting giant. But The Outsiders was before Risky Business. It was the same year, but it was before. But in Endless Love, his part is ridiculous, because the main character, Martin Hewitt, is obsessed with Brooke Shields in the movie. But she's like, there are parental issues and she doesn't want to get involved with him. And so she's sort of ignoring him. And this is driving Martin Hewitt crazy, because he wants to be with her. He's in love with her. He's absolutely in love with her. So Tom Cruise's character, who's only in, I think, maybe two scenes, plays a friend of the Martin Hewitt character. I wonder whatever happened to Martin Hewitt. He was supposed to be like this big. They were really pushing him when that movie came out. They were pushing him. He was like, he was going to be a heartthrob. He was going to be a leading man. He was a young guy. And then I don't know what the hell happened to him. I have no idea where Martin Hewitt went.
They put him in a movie leading when Tom Cruise was in the same movie.
You're right. Yeah, and Tom Cruise's career
not
took
good
off.
Luck.
Yeah. But Tom Cruise, the character that Tom Cruise plays is like a friend of his who is like, hey, you know, a friend of mine got the attention of someone by setting their back porch on fire and then saving the family. So he gives Martin Hewitt this idea to set the house on fire and then save the family, and that will, that means the family will love him and he'll be accepted, and then Brooke Shields will also, accept him. The problem is he sets the house on fire, the house burns down. So Tom Cruise's advice is not very good in the movie. And Martin Hewitt burns the house down, which, of course, does not ingratiate himself to the family or to Brooke Shields. So that's the part that Tom Cruise had in Endless Love. Yeah, why don't you set the house on fire, and then you put the fire out, you save the family, and they'll love you. It didn't work out. That didn't turn out the way it was supposed to. Endless Love. That was a terrible movie. Just a terrible movie. I remember I saw it at a, there was a, I want to say it may have been a Roy Leonard sponsored screening that I got tickets for, because Roy would host a lot of radio sponsored screenings. And I think that was one of his. I think he hosted the screening and I went to see it, and awful, just awful. So. But the song's a big hit. Everybody still loves the song. It's Diana Ross and Lionel Richie. So, but that's the only thing that people remember. But that was Tom Cruise's first movie. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We've got some A-list actors who had some surprising and ridiculous first movie roles. And if you want to jump in with your thoughts, 312-981-7200. I had some friends, Vic, who gave Tom Cruise a ride.
In Chicago?
Yeah. He was in town, and he was filming The Color of Money with Paul Newman.
Oh, I love that movie.
I do, too.
Man.
I do, too. And he had the ridiculous pompadour hair, because that's his character, had that ridiculous pompadour hair. And he obviously knows this town because Risky Business was shot here, and he spent a significant amount of time here when they were shooting Risky Business. And so, but this was when he was in town filming The Color of Money with ridiculous hair.
And, okay, I'm embarrassed, but I didn't realize they came through Chicago on that, The Color of Money.
Yeah, they do. There's a, they actually go to Chris's Billiards, on Milwaukee. They filmed a couple of scenes there, and there were a couple of other scenes that were filmed, on Lincoln Avenue, right in my old neighborhood.
Didn't film any scenes on that. There was a really cool billiard spot on Montrose that just finally closed, like within the last year. It was old school.
It's on Montrose?
Yeah, it was. It was near it was on Montrose, just east of Kimball. Actually, about a block or two east of Kimball. But yeah,
really? Okay.
Yeah, it was. I'm gonna have to think of it.
We used to go. My dad and I used to go to. I've been to Chris's many times. That's still there. It's on the second floor. Chris's Billiards on the second floor. It's on Milwaukee, right by the park, by the fire station too. It's right by the fire station on Milwaukee. And Dan, do you know you don't know the cross street where Chris is?
It is. Yeah, it's right like you said.
It's right by the firehouse,
across from the park.
Right.
The closest major street is Lawrence.
Lawrence is the closest major street, but that's where Chris is, and they film there at Color of Money. So anyway, my friends are driving. And all of a sudden, they see Tom Cruise eating an ice cream cone, standing on the street, like by the bus stop. And they roll the window down. They get to the stoplight, and there's Tom Cruise just standing there by himself, pompadour, eating an ice cream. And one of my friends is like, "Hey, Tom Cruise." He's like, "How's it going?" And he was really cool. And they're like, "Where are you going?" And he's like, "Well, I'm going up to this restaurant up here." And they're like, "We'll give you a lift." So he jumped in the car and they gave him a ride.
That's really cool because you would think a guy like Tom Cruise might be, a little nervous to hop in the car. But no, he's like, let's do it.
Yeah, but that was awesome. The thing. It was like, wait a minute, you're a movie star, man. I mean,
ride with the locals.
Can't you get a car? Can't you just have someone get you a car or like a limo or something? But he was just standing there.
It's kind of in character. Is he the type of actor that really gets into character to where even between scenes he's in? Because he may have been like that.
He gets a little method every once in a while,
That could be what he was doing, because that would be
in character.
Character with that guy.
So, but anyway, his first movie was Endless Love. And we've got a lot of other first movies that you might find amusing because it's pretty hilarious, some of them. If you want to jump in, if you remember some of the first roles that who have turned out to be A-list actors or actresses, if you want to jump in with your on thoughts and remembering those first roles, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break here and we'll come back. May as well start blowing some weed. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, baby, Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200, one artist, three songs. And Alan in North Carolina. Requesting a little ELP, man. That's Carnival number 9. By the way, we were talking about the Chris's Billiards. Chris's Billiards is at Laramie in Milwaukee. And texters are saying, Vic, the place that you were thinking of on Montrose is Marie's Golden Q. That's the place that Vic was thinking of, Marie's Golden Q. Does that sound right, Vic?
Yeah, that's it. And they had a great marquee. See if you can Google and see
what
the
their sign
of their
sign was. I should know.
It was
know.
Great, it's a very crass message.
Yes, it is very funny.
It's very hilarious, but it's hilarious. If you can look it up, Google the marquee. I'm sure there's pictures of it online.
Yeah,
I probably put a few up there. It's a very crass saying, and that was my voting station when
You're
I lived
kidding.
On the north side.
Is that right?
Yes. I think that's when I posted the picture because it's hilarious that's where I would go and vote.
Yeah. I mean, I know the place, but I can't picture what the marquee would say.
I actually went in there and asked the manager if I could do a documentary on his place. And he wouldn't do it. He was very, he didn't really want to attract a lot of attention, but that place was so old school, Nick. I mean, it was just like one of those places that they stopped at in that movie.
But Bakery Guy Mike lets us know that they've actually redesigned it now. So it's a cafe in front, but they still have pool tables in the back.
Oh, do they really?
Yeah.
That's even better.
It's so
in the back. Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Oh, yeah. All right, I'm looking
at it now.
No
drinking? There was no drinking? I mean, you were there to play pool.
No, I see that. I'm looking at the marquee, obviously, now, and I'd forgotten that they had that written up there. But, yeah, obviously, that's a very iconic sign.
Yes.
And then the little marquee thing, the little saying that they have on the bottom, obviously. Yeah.
And then I got the card from the county saying your polling station is Marie's.
That's hilarious.
It was great.
That's hilarious. You can shoot a little stick and vote.
Yeah, right.
So
while you're waiting in line.
While you're waiting, so there you go. Marie's Golden Q on Montrose. I didn't remember the sign, though. I remember the shape of the sign, but not what the saying was on their little marquee. That's pretty funny. All right. Hey, first movie roles is what we're talking about, and we were talking about Tom Cruise, you know, being the star of Endless Love. That was his first movie. Dan, have you ever seen Endless Love?
I have not.
Have we ever... I know we've talked about Endless Love before, but I just still don't know what's going on. Can you look up Martin Hewitt? I want to say it's H-E-W-I-T-T, maybe two T's, Martin Hewitt. He was the lead in the movie, and he was supposed to have this great career, and Endless Love was like, no. Does he have credits anymore?
Let's see here. Last credit was 2003. Mm-hmm. Appeared both in JAG and ER in 2003.
Oh! Yeah. Well, he was still working, but he didn't become, because they were really pushing him to be like teen heartthrob guy leading man when Endless Love came out, and it just didn't happen.
And he may be running for Congress in New Jersey right now.
Really?
Yes. I'm trying to see if it is the same. They spelled the same.
Yeah. Martin Hewitt. Congressman Martin Hewitt out of New Jersey. Wow. All right. Well, we'll look into that because we have to break here for the news, but we will look into that and find out if indeed you can vote for Martin Hewitt. Don't hold Endless Love against him when you go to the polls. All right? All right. Let's take a break. We get the news coming up, and then we are going to talk more about surprising first movie roles for A-list actors and actresses. 312-981-7200. We'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah! Little Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, man. Allen in North Carolina. C'est la vie. Now, that's not the same song, Dan, as Robbie Neville. Do you remember?
Correct.
You remember Robbie Neville?
He have the beautiful hair.
Yes, C'est la vie was a big hit for Robbie Neville in the 80s, but it's not that. That's ELP with their version of C'est la vie. Well, it's not their version. It's a different song, which just has the same title. But good old Robbie Neville. Remember when we talked about Robbie Neville and they said, is he related to the Neville brothers?
Right.
And if you look at Robbie Neville, he's about as far removed from the Neville brothers as you can possibly get. Was it Esmeralda? She was like, is he related to the Neville brothers? I'm like, no, he's a white dude. I think he might be Canadian. I don't know if Robbie Neville is Canadian. Canadian Bill would know. Anyway, that's ELP. We'll get one more because it's Triple Play Thursday.
Robbie is ours. He's from Los Angeles.
Oh, he's from Los Angeles. Okay. So we have to claim him? He's got some hair. Well, at least back in the 80s when the C'est la vie. I actually bought that record. I bought his album.
I'm looking at a semi-recent picture, and looks pretty strong. Strong. 2016, so yeah.
Yeah? All right. Robbie Neville. I wonder if he's doing any sort of nostalgia touring, as we were talking about before. I love that promo with Dean and Cochran talking about Salt and Pepper. We talked about that nostalgia tour earlier, and you know, we were asking you guys who you would like to see on a nostalgia tour, or if you've been to some of those old concerts, if they still stay with you. Vic wants Glass Tiger to reunite, and so they can tour with Robbie Neville, don't you think?
Ooh,
yeah.
Ooh,
an Informer.
Yeah, what's his name? Snow.
What a ticket.
That would be, man, oh, man, I'd pay $5,000 to see that.
Seems like Robbie Neville has also started a career playing, writing pop hits for kids, including former American Idol contestants Jordan Sparks and David Archuleta.
Really?
Also had a song on the Hannah Montana soundtrack.
Oh, good for Robbie Neville and his hair.
And on one of my favorite Tom Cruise movies, the recent Cocktail. I believe he had a song on that soundtrack.
Did he?
Called Since When.
What? Wait a minute.
We come full circle now.
How would
Tom
you
Cruise and Robbie Neville
how
connected.
Would you remember?
You are correct.
Unbelievable, Vic.
No, I can't claim that. I was looking at pictures of Robbie Neville.
All right.
And I didn't come up with that.
Okay, I was going to say, if you remembered that.
Yeah, right.
My God.
Deep cut.
That is a total
from
deep
cocktails.
Cut. From Cocktail.
I do love that movie, though.
Do you really?
I know you hate it, but I must have watched that a million times.
Yeah. Back in the day, man.
Because I was stuck in a country road in New Mexico, and Cocktail was my escape, I think.
So between killing rattlesnakes, you were watching Cocktail.
Swatting scorpions.
Swatting scorpions, killing rattlesnakes, and watching Cocktail. Boy, that sounds like a dream come true,
yeah.
Vic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was great.
That's fantastic. All right. We are talking about surprising first movie roles for a bunch of A-list actors and actresses. How about this? George Clooney's first movie. This is I don't even know what this is. George Clooney's first movie is Grizzly 2, The Concert. What does that even mean? Grizzly 2, The Concert from 1983. Now, I remember Grizzly. Grizzly was the, you know, there was a period of time in the 70s after Jaws made so much money when every other week there would be a Animal Strikes Back or Nature Strikes Back movie. You know, but as soon as Jaws made all that money, then it was all, it was like every week there was another animal movie. The Day of the Animals, if you want something hilarious, rent The Day of the Animals and you get to see a shirtless Leslie Nielsen fight a bear in Day of the Animals. But Grizzly 2, The Concert, George Clooney's first movie, The Ocean's 11 star, did not have a most auspicious start. Grizzly 2 was a sequel to the 1976 film about a giant man-eating bear. The film, which also features a very young Charlie Sheen, was never released, but features Clooney in a nameless role that has him camping out with a lover before being mauled by the bear. Clooney's released film debut came in Return to Horror High. He was also in Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, or Attack of the, yeah, the Killer Tomatoes 2, the sequel, right? Yeah. So he started out in horror movies, Clooney. I have never seen Grizzly 2, The Concert, but it's because it's never been released. Why was it? I'm really curious as to why the subtitle is The Concert. Was it singing bears? Is that what's going on? Or there's an outdoor concert and there people are going to the outdoor concert and the bears kill them?
Yeah, I think you are correct based upon the description. All hell breaks loose when a giant grizzly reacting to the slaughter of grizzlies by poachers attacks. By poachers, attacks at a massive Big Bang rock concert at a national park.
That is hilarious. That is hilarious. All right, George Clooney. There he was, getting killed by a grizzly in his first movie. Here's Doc in KC. Hi, Doc.
Hey, how's it going? All right. Another good topic.
Thanks.
Hey, you know, sometimes you just always associate people with the first movie you saw them in.
Yeah.
You know, you remind yourself that Dead Man Walking was once Jeff Spicoli, you know.
Right.
But I was thinking Ben Affleck. I don't know if his first movie was Dazed Confused. But when I see that guy, I can't help but think he's just a sphincter.
Yeah.
From his performance in that movie.
Yeah.
And another one, Nicole Kidman. First thing I saw her in was To Die For. And ever since then, I've seen her, I think, this guy will kill you if they help her for a couple of days.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think Affleck made a couple of movies when he was a kid. So I think I think Dazed was maybe his fourth or fifth movie or sixth movie or something like that. But he still was an unknown. Nicole Kidman made a lot of movies before To Die For. And she was in, if I'm not mistaken, Dan, I think she was in Rad. Or one of those motocross movies. I think she was in Rad or one of, I think that was her first movie. The first time I ever saw her, the first time I remember seeing her was in a movie called Dead Calm with Billy Zane, her and Billy Zane on a boat, and he plays a lunatic. And she's really great in that. That was the first time I remember seeing Nicole Kidman.
And when you talk about kids, that's its own category, like Dakota Fanning, I Am Sam.
Yeah.
I don't know if Haley Joel Osment, Sixth Sense, was his first.
No, you
movie
know, you
or
know
not.
His, you know what
then
his,
to
you,
me,
you know what his first movie was? Haley Joel Osment?
Uh-uh.
Forrest Gump. He played Forrest Gump's son at the end of the movie. That's Haley Joel.
Oh, wow.
Osment. Yeah, that's Haley Joel Osment.
And to me, one of the all-time, I don't know if it was his first, but Ricky Schroeder and The Champ.
Yeah.
How can you watch that? And then Timothy Hutton wasn't Ordinary People. His first movie?
I think it was his first movie, and he won an Oscar for it.
The Oscar.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, Doc, thanks, man.
All right, have a good morning.
You too.
BMX Bandits.
That's what it was. I knew she was in like a BMX, but it wasn't Rad, but and she's got some hair in that movie. Like, you know, big, curly, crazy hair. Because she used to have big, curly, crazy hair. Like there, if there are some early pictures of Nicole Kidman, I mean, we're talking like a big, big red, curly, crazy hair. But, yeah. All right, you know Johnny Depp's first movie, right, Dan?
I do.
Yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street was his first movie. He got sucked into the bed, and then blood went flying everywhere. He's got a great line in that movie where like he's walking around outside or something like that, and Freddy's like, you know, around, and he's like, "I'll punch your ugly lights out, whoever you are." That's one of Johnny Depp's lines. "I'll punch your ugly lights out, whoever you are." How about DiCaprio? His first movie, Critters 3. There's apparently a trend of ultra-famous male actors starting in horror films. In Critters 3, DiCaprio plays Josh, who has a memorable scene as he watches the critters kill his stepdad. DiCaprio actually joined the TV show Growing Pains in the same year, and it's obvious that TV fared better for him at the time. Critters 3. I've seen Critters 3. I enjoyed the first Critters very much. Kerry Washington was in a movie called Our Song back in 2000. She plays Lanisha Brown, a 15-year-old who, with her two best friends, is a dedicated member of the Jackie Robinson Steppers, a community marching band. The film follows their choices after the high school closes for asbestos removal. What? Based on the trailer, it seems like the kind of dramatic vehicle Washington would come to thrive in. All right. Wow. All right. How about this one? Amy Adams. Amy Adams was in Drop Dead Gorgeous, which, by the way, is a hilarious movie. If you've never seen it, you should. Have you seen, Dan,
No.
It's really funny. It's really funny. And it's become a cult classic. It's about teen beauty pageants. And Kirsten Dunst is in it. Kirstie Alley, Denise Richards, Ellen Barkin, and it was also Amy Adams' first movie. She plays Leslie Miller, a kind yet vapid and sexy beauty pageant contestant. Adams steals every scene she can and proves she can be quite the cheerleader. I have to go back and rewatch that now because it's a funny movie. It's a very, very funny movie. Particularly, Ellen Barkin is hilarious in Drop Dead Gorgeous. I remember I saw that on my birthday in 1999. I remember we saw it, my ex-wife and I saw it on my birthday at the 600 North Michigan Theater, which, by the way, I will be at tonight watching Suspiria. That's where I'm seeing Suspiria. How about Matt Damon? His first movie was Mystic Pizza. Oh, man, I don't even remember. I mean, I remember Mystic Pizza, but wow. Before he was Jason Bourne or Will Hunting, Matt Damon was Steamer. Steamer, the younger brother whose palate wasn't as refined as his rich family's. You watch the scene in which Daisy, played by Julia Roberts, attends a dinner with Charlie's family, played by Adam Stork, where nothing seems to go right. Damon's aw shucks face proves he only got better with age. Wow, Mystic Pizza. I saw a picture, like a still from him in that. He's got some hair in that movie, in Mystic Pizza. Matt Damon's got some serious hair issues. We got some texts coming in. If you guys want to jump in, 312-981-7200 for first rolls. And, you know, great stuff like Grizzly 2, the concert featuring George Clooney. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Steve says, Tom Selleck was handpicked by Mae West to appear in Myra Breckinridge with her. It was his first movie. Wow, I didn't know that. What a terrible movie that is. 301 area code says, Roy Scheider was in Curse of the Living Corpse. He even wrote an article once about making the movie. Wow. Roy Scheider, Curse of the Living Corpse. Sounds like great viewing. It's, you know, it's not surprising, Dan, that so many people start out in horror movies.
Right.
You know, it's just, that's what, you know, the parts are easy to get. They're low budget. You can just, you know, you get your resume going.
A lot of made, yeah. Because I remember when Jennifer Lawrence was hitting it big for Winter's Bone, and I forget what remake she'd done, but it was right around that time that, you know, it was the movie done.
Like the house at the end of the lane or something like that. 630 area code says, years ago, my wife and I binge-watched Dark Shadows, the old soap opera, on DVD. We thought we saw a young Harvey Keitel as an extra in a bar scene. About a year later, I ran into him at LAX waiting for a flight, and we struck up a conversation. And I asked him about this, and he said it was his first ever paid screen time, and he got $10. Kate Jackson also started her acting career on Dark Shadows. That's pretty cool that you can just have a conversation with Harvey Keitel at an airport. That's what I get from that. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back, and we want to hear from you guys. Weird first movie roles for A-listers. Triple Play Thursday, everybody. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Get your requests in now. 312-981-7200. Allen, North Carolina. That was ELP's cover of the Peter Gunn theme. Welcome back, everybody. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on WGN. Coming up at 5 is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. And coming up at 6 is Steve Cochran. And coming up soon are the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, we are talking about weird first movie roles for A-listers. And we've been going through some of these first roles for these people. And if you want to jump in with you remembering the first roles of people who would go on to become major stars, and we're discovering that a lot of big actors got their start in horror movies, which of course makes sense. That's how so many actors have started out. But if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Here's Ken on WGN. Hi, Ken.
Hey, Nick. I've been a Nick U fan since Steve and Johnny, so
oh,
I'm excited to be working the third shift again just to be able to hear you.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Well, a lot of people don't know this. Jim Carrey. Most people think that his first role was Once Bitten. It's a small B movie called Rubberface. It's actually more of a documentary, actually. It's him trying to make it as a stand-up.
Ah.
And he's in Jim Carrey-esque character as well.
Well, I just looked it up. It's a TV movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a TV movie, and it's Jim Carrey in Rubberface. There it is.
Yeah, my sister and I used to watch movies all the time when we were kids, going through all the horror sections and stuff, and one of them small, you know, video stores that'll have, like, those, you know, B-movies that you don't really see anywhere else.
Yeah.
And that's where I saw it the first time, and I knew a kid who was, like, a big Jim Carrey fan, and he didn't even know that.
Yeah, well, you know what, it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of actors and actresses do these movies early in their career that get buried, and then once they become, you know, huge, they get re-released. You know what I mean? Like, suddenly, like, I'm sure, like, after Ace Ventura, they were like, let's find anything and everything that Jim Carrey did early in his career and get it out there now.
Yeah, as long as it's not porn.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thanks, man.
All right.
Okay. You know, I was just looking up Jim Carrey here because, you know, I always thought his theatrical film debut was Once Bitten, but I just looked up Jim Carrey. He was in a Canadian movie, maybe Canadian Bill, because Jim Carrey is Canadian. Maybe Canadian Bill knows this movie. It's now get this description, Dan. It's called All in Good Taste from 1983. And it's wacky. The poster is wacky. It says, their first encounter with a nudist camp. It's all in good taste. But here's the plot. You ready for the plot, Dan? A filmmaker is upset to find out that his wholesome script, about an orphan and his dog has been warped into a film about strippers. All in good taste. So that seems to be the first theatrical movie that he made. I don't think it never got released in America. Maybe it was a big hit in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Saga's not on the soundtrack. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Chris in Elk Grove says, it was one of his first movies, but I remember Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger were in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 together. Yeah, it was the return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And it was McConaughey's second movie, because his first movie is Dazed. Dazed and Confused is his first movie. I think Jennifer Aniston's first movie was Leprechaun. Yes, we all know that's kind of infamous because she's got a different nose in Leprechaun. Isn't that what that's what everybody says? 708 area code says, I really don't remember the title, but there was a TV show, and I remember watching it about 25 years ago, and it had Jennifer Lopez and Edward Olmos as her father. I remember seeing Jennifer Lopez's name and thinking that she was going to be big. I think it had something to do with working at a hotel. I know it's not a movie, but I think it was her first acting gig. I can't find anything about this, though. Edward James almost plays her father, and then working in a hotel. I don't know. Anybody remember that? Wild Bill says author Scott Spencer wrote the original novel Endless Love based on his relationship with the older sister of a one-time classmate of mine. After 50 years, I just reconnected with this classmate on Facebook. Wow. 574 area code. My favorite action hero, Chuck Norris, was a bad guy in 1973's Karate Cop, also known as Yellow-Faced Tiger. Well, he's in Return of the Dragon, Chuck Norris. He's got a big fight scene with Bruce Lee in Return of the Dragon. And I'll tell you something about Chuck Norris. If you watch that scene from Return of the Dragon, he clearly had some serious waxing done on his back after that. You know what I'm talking about? Because he had some serious hair. I mean, he was like Robin Williams hairy in that scene in Return of the Dragon. Julia Roberts' first movie was a movie called Satisfaction. She had been a star of the film since Mystic Pizza, but before that she made a small handful of roles. Her first film was Firehouse, but her first credited film role was as Daryl in Satisfaction, starring Justine Bateman and Liam Neeson. Roberts and Bateman are members of an all-rock group trying to make it for themselves. I remember seeing that movie in the theater. Satisfaction is a terrible movie. Terrible movie. Tom Hanks. Oh, yeah, another horror movie. Tom Hanks' first movie was a slasher movie called He Knows You're Alone. That came out at the height of the slasher genre. And it was one of, like, I mean, I've said this before. When I went to high school, there were three types of movies that were released, like, every Friday. There were slasher movies that usually were named after some sort of holiday. They would come out. I mean, this was like through high school. This was the most popular. And then the teen sex comedy, the TNA movies, you know, like your Porky's and other ones. Those are Private School and all that stuff. Those all came. And Cheech and Chong movies.
Written by the same guys who wrote the movie in good taste.
Right. here's what Tom Hanks, they say. Before he was one of the most established actors and a constant Meg Ryan love interest, Tom Hanks played Elliot, a psychology student who meets the female lead of this 80s slasher while jogging through a forest. He provides the meta look at horror films and comments on people's desire to pay to be scared. It doesn't seem as if there's much of a point to his role, but He Knows You're Alone plays at our primal fears and is a worthwhile 80s slasher film. No, it isn't. Whoever wrote this, it's a terrible movie. So, all right. Actors' first roles. Some of them are weird, as we're learning. 312-981-7200. The news is coming up next. I love this song. 815 area code with the Plimsolls and A Million Miles Away. Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Now, here's the thing, though, Dan. I know more than three songs by the Plimsolls, but the public really doesn't, because that was kind of their only kind of hit. And it's from the Valley Girl soundtrack. That's the they're featured in Valley Girl. The band is in Valley Girl, and I just love that song. And then I became a Plimsolls fan. Me and Hey Listen, we're like huge Plimsolls fans. But they don't have three hits. I can tell you that right now. But I mean, I know more than three songs by them only because I was one of the big fans of those guys. Because as soon as I saw Valley Girl and I saw them in it, I was like, well, man, this is a jam. So, Plimsolls on Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Yeah! 312-981-7200. I'll learn how to speak. Again, tomorrow morning, if you might want to tune in, because I'm going to be loopy. I'm going to be looped. It's a good thing we're talking about space tomorrow, because I'm going to be very spacey. See what I did right there?
Well done.
Rod Pyle is going to join us tomorrow. He's, the guy's probably got 15 more books that he's written. He's a space expert, and we're going to talk about a bunch of space news that we've got to get to. A lot of stuff actually happened space-wise, but we also have to talk about what he thought about First Man, because we know, Dan, that he saw First Man.
Yes, that is correct.
I am so excited to talk to him about it. I really hope he liked it. And I really hope that it's, you know, I mean, he'll nitpick it because he can nitpick it to death.
Right.
Because he knows, you know, authenticity when it comes to, you know, like space stuff. I really hope it's accurate. I really hope it's accurate because I loved the movie. I absolutely loved it. So, but we'll talk with Rod. That'll be tomorrow. And then about an hour and a half after Rod leaves, I will be nuts. Because I am not going to do my regular sleep pattern. I'm sacrificing some sleep so I can go see the new Suspiria tonight. So, yeah. Yeah. I can barely speak now. So, we are in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows with the opening bell, the great Steve Cochran at 6. And I get to hang out with Cochran and the gang at 6:20 to talk about the new movies and pop culture stuff. It's always a lot of fun. Hey, what are you doing? 312-981-7200. Join us, won't you? We're talking about very strange or weird first movie roles for A-listers and remembering some of the first performances by these people before they became megastars and award winners. A lot of people have to start from the beginning, like George Clooney in Grizzly 2, The Concert, DiCaprio in Critters 3. So, all right, how about this one? Now, I remember seeing this movie in the theater, Dan. Denzel Washington's first movie, Carbon Copy.
Mm.
Denzel Washington is known for playing more dramatic and action-based roles, so his first credited role in a feature film seems out of repertoire. Carbon Copy is a comedy about a white business executive who discovers that he has a black teenage son, played by Denzel Washington, who was 27 at the time. And that white business executive was played by George Segal. George Segal, who is currently on the Jeff Garlin Goldbergs. Now, but there was a time, Dan, when George Segal was in everything. Like in the late 70s, early 80s, George Segal was in everything. Romantic comedies, he was in thrillers. And Carbon Copy was a George. It was a George Segal vehicle, and Denzel was in it. I remember I saw it at the Portage. I saw it at the Portage Theater, and it sucked. It was a terrible movie. What was the other one, Dan? Bob Hoskins and Denzel Washington, and he played a cop. Heart Condition. That was another.
Yes.
A terrible movie. A terrible movie. It, with Hoskins and Denzel Washington, two of the greatest actors of all time. What do they say about that one? What year was that?
Year 1990.
Ooh, it's really 90?
Yep. A racist cop receives a heart transplant from a black lawyer he hates, who returns as a ghost to ask the cop to help him take down the man who murdered him.
Wow, man.
Yeah.
Man, and that's post-Glory, so there's no excuse. There's no excuse, man. Wow. Well, I thought that was much earlier in his career, but no, that's like wheelhouse Denzel. That was after Denzel had been established at that point. Oh, I remember hating that movie. Oh, man. All right. Emma Stone's first movie was Superbad. I didn't know that. I thought she must have been in something before that. Wow. What a way to come out. I mean, what a great first movie. This is one that she should not be embarrassed about. Boy, she just, what a great career Emma Stone has had. Coming out of the gate with Superbad, that's your first movie, and continuing to take good roles? I gotta say, you know, that Emma Stone is one of those people who makes really good decisions, I think. Have you seen Maniac on Netflix with her, speaking of Jonah Hill?
I have not.
It's so good and so weird. Like, really weird, but really good. Emma Stone knew her comedic brand from the beginning. Stone was a breakout as Jules in Judd Apatow's beloved Superbad, memorably not noticing Jonah Hill's antics in Home Economic Class. After Superbad, Stone quickly added well-known titles to her resume like Zombieland, Ghosts of Girlfriends Past, and The House Bunny, before becoming widely recognized in 2010's Easy A. That was her breakthrough right there, Easy A. She was in Ghosts of Girlfriends Past with my main man, McConaughey. I remember her in The House Bunny. That's a funny movie. Have you seen The House Bunny?
Just bits and pieces of
it. It's really funny. And Anna Faris is great in it. Meryl Streep in Julia. God, here's another one. I mean, what kind of career, Meryl Streep? She's out of the gate. She's in Julia, which was like an Oscar-nominated, insane, critically acclaimed movie, and that was her first movie. And then she went on to do, like, Deer Hunter? I mean, what do you... Before she became the actress with the most Oscar nominations, Streep played a minor supporting role in Julia, which starred Jane Fonda and Vanessa Redgrave. The film was about playwright Lillian, played by Fonda, and her relationship with her friend Julia, who asks her to smuggle funds into Nazi Germany. So, there you go. Let's see. Here is Thomas on WGN. Hi, Thomas.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Hi. Yes, I was wondering, as memory serves me correctly, June Lockhart was the mother in Lassie.
Yes.
And then later on, she went on to star in Lost in Space. And I also have a question to ask you. When you tell your joke on Sunday morning or Monday morning, a jokey joke, sometimes it's hard to stay up that late. I was wondering if you could maybe tell that joke, like the joke from that night, the next on the beginning of the Monday morning show next week, correct? I hate to miss your joke.
Oh.
And thank you.
All right. Take care, Thomas. He hates to miss my dad's jokes. What was the joke this past week? I'm trying to remember what it was. Oh. Everything is, everything has a drive-through now. Even, what was it? Even funeral parlors have a drive-through. They've just opened up Jump in a Box. That was the, right? That's close,
that's
right?
It, yeah.
People don't want to miss my dad's jokes, man. Well, they get podcast. You know, that's, you can always, right? You podcast those separately. So it's just the joke. So you check out WGNRadio.com. You can listen to it at your leisure, bro. Oh, I forgot to do this. All right. Lupita Nyong'o's first movie was 12 Years a Slave. We knew that. What's really shocking about Lupita Nyong'o's first film is that there wasn't one before it. She's easily recognized because it's the film that instantly planted her on Hollywood's A-list and earned her an Oscar. She plays Patsy, a young tortured slave. For a first gig after graduating Yale School of Drama, she could have done worse. Right out of the gate, she gets an Oscar. Ryan Gosling's first movie was Frankenstein and Me. Ryan Gosling is as charismatic as ever in this supporting role in this film starring Burt Reynolds. Gosling plays Kenny, a friend of the lead character who wants to bring Frankenstein to life. What? What is this movie? And why are we showing Longest Yard and not this? On this November 13th. Now, see, now Gosling though, Dan, I mean, he was already a kid actor, right? I mean, because he was in the Disney thing,
yeah, the Mickey Mouse Club.
So, but this was his first. What the hell is Frankenstein and Me? And why haven't I not seen it? Burt Reynolds in a Frankenstein movie? Oh, this has got to, is it available? On DVD? Let me look this thing up here. Wait a minute. This is just ridiculous. Wait a minute.
It looks like it was released in Canada, so...
Just in Canada?
Well, I don't know if it ever made it stateside, but initially it was Canada.
Let's see, yeah. How does... Where's Burt Reynolds? I'm looking at the cast list now. Oh, there he is.
Available on VHS tape for 15 bones.
You can get it for 15 bucks on VHS.
Yep.
All right. This is ridiculous, man. It's a comedy family fantasy from Canada, released in 1996. And there it is. Burt Reynolds was in Frankenstein and Me. I have to see this. I have to see it. It was ridiculous. All right. Let's take a break here on WGN, and we'll come back. We've got more weird first movie roles for future A-listers. And if you'd like to jump in here, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. 815 area code requesting the Plimsolls with How Long Will It Take on Triple Play Thursday. You mean Triple Play Thursday? It's one artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right. Yeah, no, nobody knows that song, Dan, but I do.
The two of you do.
Yeah, just the two of us, me and 815.
And the Plimsolls.
Yeah, and the Plimsolls themselves, yes. All right, we are talking about...
Unless one of the members of the Plimsolls moved to 815.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, that could be.
He's reminiscing about the old days.
Remembering the old days. Let's see. We're talking about A-listers who got off to either a good start or a bad start with their first movie roles. And we've been looking back at the A-listers who were young. Many of them started out in bad movies and horror movies and things like that. Some came out good. We were just looking up Ryan Gosling's first movie. It's called Frankenstein and Me, which I have to see this movie. Burt Reynolds in a Frankenstein movie. How did I miss this one? How did that get past me? Wow. All right. Jennifer Lawrence's first movie was Garden Party. Before she sat at the top of Hollywood's A-list, Jennifer Lawrence got her start in guest roles on Monk and Cold Case until she made her film debut in Garden Party. In the movie, she plays Tiff, a friend of the main character who finds herself in more than one struggle. Do not know Garden Party. I wonder if it got released. Yeah, because I always thought Winter's Bone was her first movie. So, Garden Party. I don't know. Well, let me see what this one is. All right. 2008. Garden Party. And came out in 2008. Was released in May. April, age 15, is running from one bad situation into another, hoping to find an answer that doesn't involve nudity. And falls in love with a group of confused kids chasing their dreams. The Black Widow in the web is the sexy, pot-dealing Sally. That's Garden Party. And, yeah, nobody else of name is in it. Oh, well, Fiona Dourif is in it. Brad Dourif's daughter, who I met at Flashback this past summer. She's pretty cool. So, yeah, Garden Party. Never heard of it before. But that was Jennifer Lawrence's first movie. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. All right, here's Harold. Go ahead, Harold.
Hey, what's up? Dennis Hopper, Rebel Without a Cause. He had done a couple TV things before that, but that was the first movie.
Yeah, Rebel Without a Cause.
Rebel Without a Cause.
Yep, that was his first movie, and he had told amazing stories about the making of that movie. And that's a hell of a first movie right there. And it did end up hanging out and becoming really good friends with James Dean and Natalie Wood. Rebel Without a Cause. Dennis Hopper starting out really good. So there you go. Harold, thanks for the call. Let's see Dave. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
Can we name a television show where an actor might have gotten his start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, do you remember a show, an old black and white one called The Naked City?
Sure.
John Voight had a role in one. He was like a 14 or 15-year-old kid. Mm. Big, tall guy, baby blonde hair, baby-faced, but he was really big and a big kid in that one. I don't remember what episode, but I remember seeing him in one.
Oh, Naked City. Yeah, that's a classic show. And that was John Voight's first role. All right, Dave, thanks.
Thanks.
Take care. John Voight, man. We got some texts coming in, too. 312-981-7200, 773 area code. Sends a text that says, don't forget Lily Taylor's first movie was also Mystic Pizza. Yeah, that was her first movie, wasn't it? 319 area code says, Helen Hunt was in an after-school special where she was on drugs and she flew out a window. They've shown that. She's gone on talk shows, and they actually show that clip. Like, she has a really fun time with it. It was one of these after school specials as the listener describes. It's an after school special, and it's really funny because I don't know what drug she's on. But she goes nuts because she's on drugs, and she's a kid in the movie. She's probably like 13, 14 years old in it. And I don't know what the drug is, But she goes completely nuts, and then flings herself out a window screaming all the way down. And I've seen on several, so she's been on several talk shows where they've played that clip. I know that Conan has played it when she's been on. So I think that's a great bit. You know, I love that bit, Dan, whenever, you know this bit, right, with Paul Rudd, when Paul Rudd shows up on Conan to plug a movie. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
I think it's one of the greatest things ever. Every time Paul Rudd is on to plug a movie, no matter what it is, every time they say they're going to show a clip from the movie that he's there to plug, they show a scene from the movie Mac and Me, where the kid flies over he's like on a motor or on a motorcycle or something, or a bike. And Mac and Me was this terrible, really cheap E.T. ripoff. And so whenever he's on Conan, whenever Paul Rudd's on Conan, that's the clip they show. They eventually show a real clip, you know, like if he's there to promote Ant-Man, they'll first show the Mac and Me clip because they do it every single time he's on the show. It's funny, and it's funny every time. It's funny because the clip is ridiculous. This Mac and Me, the Mac character, the space alien character, worst puppet, most ridiculous, cheap-looking special effects puppet that you can possibly imagine. And he goes, ooh, like he acts frightened because the kid goes flying. Every time he's on Conan, they show that clip from Mac and Me, and it kills every time. It's funny every single time. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. Later on in the show, by the way, the NBA season has kicked off. The Bulls kick off their regular season tonight. We're going to talk about how the teams in the NBA got their names. But we're going to continue talking about A-listers who started off in maybe weird movies. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and the news is next. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. It's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday! That's one artist, three songs. 815 area code, requesting the Plimsolls with My Life Ain't Easy. Okay, welcome back, everybody. We're talking about actors in their first roles. A-listers sometimes start off weird. And so 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. And a little bit later on, we're going to talk about in honor of the NBA starting and the Bulls kicking off their regular season tonight. We're going to tell you about how every NBA team got their name, where that came from. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Here we go. Hey, Benicio Del Toro's first movie was Big Top Pee Wee. Benicio Del Toro might have foreshadowed his Wolfman performance in 2010. Surprisingly, he made his film debut in the Pee Wee Herman flop Big Top Pee Wee as Duke the Dog-Faced Boy. And he's basically unrecognizable. That was one of the, I have to say, Big Top Pee Wee was one of the biggest disappointments ever. Because I love, you know, Pee-wee's Playhouse, one of the greatest television shows of all time. Like, truly, one of the greatest TV shows of all time. And Pee-wee's Big Adventure, one of my favorite movies ever. And I was so excited for Big Top Pee-wee, and it was terrible. It was terrible. And I do remember Duke the Dog-Faced Boy. It was Benicio Del Toro. Natalie Portman's first movie is Leon the Professional. Portman's first role in the French action hit Leon the Professional showed a bountiful career was in her future. Portman played Matilda, a 12-year-old who made her enter smoking a cigarette and sporting a black eye. How about this one? Cuba Gooding Jr. coming to America. This is really funny because I noticed it probably, you know, a couple of years ago when I rewatched Coming to America. I'm like, hey, that's Cuba Gooding Jr. Do you recognize him, Dan?
I did not realize it was him.
Yeah. Cuba Gooding Jr. made his film debut in the Eddie Murphy classic Coming to America. He never said a word. Instead, his character, dubbed by IMDb as Boy Getting Haircut, sat observing and laughing at the old men talking about boxing in the barbershop. He's in one of the funniest scenes in the movie. And he's just sitting there getting a haircut. But it's him. You know what I mean? So, let's see. Stephen Plainfield said a pretty good film career started with a person bending over and getting his backside paddled in a fraternity house, Kevin Bacon in Animal House. Yeah, he played Chip in Animal House. And he gets run over by a crowd at the end and flattened into the sidewalk. I don't know if people remember that or not. 651 area code. Kevin Costner played the corpse of a college friend in The Big Chill. Well, he got cut out of the movie. He was actually, he had scenes. And Lawrence Kasdan cut him out of the movie. And his he is the corpse. Like his wrists, you get to see Kevin Costner's wrists and I think his shoulder in it. And as, but this is a true story. So Lawrence Kasdan cut him out of the movie. And it was, you know, like this was, you know, like The Big Chill, whether you like it or not, and I don't very much. That was a big, it was a huge movie. Not only just because the soundtrack was fantastic, it was all the Motown songs, but all of those people, you know, that lifted up their careers huge. Every single person in The Big Chill got a huge boost from their career. Best performance in that movie is Jeff Goldblum, which is not a surprise. But it's an Costner was so upset because, like, that movie was a big hit and he had scenes in it and they cut him out. So Kasdan gave him the role in Silverado. That it was his breakout role in Silverado. And he cast him. He's like, I'm sorry. I cut you out of The Big Chill. Here, have this role in Silverado. And that was the breakthrough role for him. His face was cut out in editing, but Samuel L. Jackson played a nerd number two relegated to the couch in Animal House. And then 847 area code says, what was Steve Cochran's first movie, Grumpy Old Men or Drop Dead Fred? I think Drop Dead Fred was first. I think Drop Dead Fred came out first. I'm almost positive on that. And again, as I've said before, the highlight, I think Steve Cochran has to say that the highlight of his entire career, and he's had a great career, both as an actor and a stand-up, and obviously as a great radio host. But, I mean, the highlight is, you know, he's in a movie where Walter Matthau tells him to shut up, fat ass. I mean, that's, come on. Walter Matthau, man. Shut up, fat ass. Frank says, was Steve McQueen's first movie The Blob? Well, one of his first movies. I don't know if it was his very first, but yes, he was. That was one of his first movies, maybe his first. And was James Arness' first movie the original Thing? I think it was. 773 area code says, hey, Nick, Barbara Streisand's first movie was Funny Girl. She won an Oscar. Goldie Hawn's first movie was Cactus Flower. She won an Oscar. And Warren Beatty's first movie was Splendor in the Grass. Yeah, those are great ways to start right there. 630 area code says Lawrence Fishburne was credited as Larry Fishburne in Apocalypse Now. He's a soldier dancing on the PT boat. He was 13 when he made that movie. And yeah, you know, for the first part of his career, he was Larry Fishburne. If you go back and look, I'm trying to remember when he became Lawrence Fishburne. And, you know, the story behind it was he was Larry Fishburne for, you know, the first part of his career. I think he's credited as Larry Fishburne at least 7, 8, 10 movies. And then there was this great African-American actor named Roscoe Brown who was doing a play with him. And, Lawrence Fishburne was, you know, he didn't like the fact that he had to be Larry Fishburne. His full name is Lawrence, and he wanted, and Roscoe Brown gave him a speech about how he needs to own his own identity and he needs to be Lawrence Fishburne. So he got this really inspirational speech from this, you know, legendary African-American actor, and then he changed his name back to Lawrence Fishburne. But yeah, Apocalypse Now, he was like, I want to say when they started shooting that movie, because that movie took forever to shoot. I think he was 14 maybe when they started it. If you go back and look at that movie, he's a kid. Lawrence Fishburne is a kid in that movie. It's really kind of amazing. 301 area code says, Frankenstein and Me is a good movie. I have it on Laserdisc. So the only way you can see this movie is with formats that are gone. So, like, it's available on Laserdisc and VHS. So that's how you're going to see it. Frankenstein and Me is a good movie. It's a good movie. Wow. Scott from Gurnee says, it's not their first film, but a really strange one. Jim Carrey and Jeff Goldblum star in the 1988 film Earth Girls Are Easy. You know who else is in that movie? Damon Wayans. That's a good movie, man. That's a really good movie. It's Jim Carrey. I think that's Jim Carrey's second movie after Once Bitten. And Damon Wayans. So you got two guys who would go on to In Living Color. in this movie, and Gina Davis, and it was written by Julie Brown. That's a good movie, man. Julian Temple directed that movie. That's a really good movie and very funny and very creative. Canadian Bill says most A-listers from Canada are in Canadian movies that no one has ever heard of. We're learning that this morning. We're definitely learning that. Lots of Canadian movies just don't make it to America. So, Brad Pitt was in a movie called The Dark Side of the Sun. Pitt has a few uncredited roles to his name, like in Charlie Sheen's No Man's Land, before landing his first credited role in the American Yugoslavian drama The Dark Side of the Sun. Pitt plays Rick, who has a rare skin disease that prevents him from exposing himself to any kind of light, especially sunlight. Is he the lead? Because, you know, the title is The Dark Side of the Sun. I would imagine he's got to have a major part. You know what, Brad Pitt is in a fantastic Pringles commercial. I don't know if you've ever seen, Dan, have you ever seen the old Pringles commercial with Brad Pitt? He plays like a surfer dude with his friends, and they're having so much fun on the beach eating Pringles and like driving around in a convertible. Yeah, man, Pringles! And he's got some crazy hair in it. Yeah, it's Brad Pitt, plays like a surfer dude who is enjoying his Pringles. Margot Robbie's first movie was Vigilante. Margot Robbie has a skyrocketing career, but before she broke into the American entertainment world, Robbie was in Vigilante, a small Australian film. She plays Cassandra, whose rape sparks her fiancé to train to become a master of hand-to-hand combat and fight crime. Well, that sounds terrible. Viola Davis's first movie was The Substance of Fire back in 1996. The story of Viola Davis's first film gig isn't very cushy. Her character in The Substance of Fire, which stars Tony Goldwyn and Sarah Jessica Parker, is called Nurse and is seen for only a few minutes as she hands a vial of blood to Timothy Hutton. According to TV Insider, Davis said she did one day's work and was paid $518 for the role. Okay. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to talk or text. We're going to wrap up this discussion about actors and their first roles, whether they're good or bad. And then we're going to, after the news, we'll jump into the NBA stuff and tell you about the names of the teams and how that happened. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's take a break here for the weather. Welcome back, everybody. Triple Play Thursday continues. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200. That's one artist, three songs. Doc requesting Jackson Brown and The Pretender. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Coming up after 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, we have been talking about actors and A-listers who have had, you know, what their first roles were, their early career stuff. And it's a lot of fun to look back at this kind of stuff. Ryan Gosling, Frankenstein and Me with Burt Reynolds, which is a good movie. And by the way, it's available on VHS and Laserdisc if you're looking to get it. let's see. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right, man.
Yeah. Sandy Newton, an early movie of hers was Flirting with took place at an Australian boarding school.
That's Nicole Kidman.
Nicole Kidman and Noah Taylor.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
That's a really great movie.
Oh man. I didn't even remember that Sandy Newton was in that.
Yeah, she played the daughter of Nigerian ambassador. She was Noah Taylor's love interest in the movie.
Oh wow! I have to go back and watch that one because I really, really enjoyed. Yeah. I remember really enjoying that movie. Was she in that movie with Tupac and Tim Roth?
I believe so. I know what you're talking about.
Oh,
I never
man, what the hell was
that?
It was a great. It was a great movie too. A really great movie. Oh man!
Lawrence Fishburne's first movie actually was several years before Apocalypse Now, Cornbread Earl and Me, where he played the Me, and former NBA star, UCLA basketball star Keith Wilkes, later Jamal Wilkes, played Cornbread.
Yeah. And that's a movie. I saw that movie in the theaters. I remember that. That was a good movie.
Yeah
that's a good one. By the way, the movie was Gridlocked. Thank you, Dan.
Gridlocked.
It's
a
terrific
movie.
Wasn't
that directed by, I can't remember.
Was Bill Duke? Is it Bill Duke?
No, not Bill. Another Vondi black director.
Curtis Hall.
His wife is Cassie Lemons. Yeah, I can't remember his name.
Vondi Curtis Hall.
Yeah. Right.
That's a really terrific movie. If people have not seen it, it's Tupac, Tim Roth, and Thandie Newton. It's called Gridlock.
Isn't Belushi in that too?
No, that's a different one.
Oh, okay.
You're thinking of a different. You're thinking of it was Tupac and Jim Belushi.
Yeah.
And it was a cop. It was a cop movie.
Oh, okay.
And I can't remember what the hell that one was called, but it was Tupac and Jim Belushi. But no.
All right, Nick.
All right, buddy.
Thanks,
man.
Take care.
Yeah. Thandie Newton, star of Flirting. It's a really great movie, though. There it is, gang-related. That's the dream team right there. Tupac and Jim Belushi. Yeah, that's not good, but Gridlocked is good. Gridlocked is really, really good. Here's Chuck on WGN. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, Chuck from Dolan. I got a Screen Actors Guild check yesterday from the Screen Actors Guild for $35. I don't know what it was for, but it was enough to give me some beer. I play Santa, and my first Santa gig was a Kmart commercial where all they did was film me from the beard down, and I held T-shirts, towels. Then I worked my way up to where I did another Sears commercial for a learning commercial, how to wear an elf's hat properly at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kept working my way up because I'm the Brookfield Zoo Santa. This will be my 12th year out there.
Yeah.
And I worked my way up to Chicago Med last year, and I was a dead Santa.
A dead Santa. Okay.
It's really weird how you work your way up the food chain to try to get yourself into like a little movie or something like that. It actually, you go through a lot of tryouts. It takes a lot of work and a lot of time.
Yeah, I bet. Well, we're getting to the busy time of year for you, right, Chuck?
Oh yeah, I'm going to be at the Brookfield Zoo for 4 weekends at night and evening. I'm not the brunch with Santa. That's a fake beard Santa. I'm real beard Santa.
Right.
And I'm at nighttime. I'll be in the fish tank there where the big dolphin tank is.
Right.
I'm in the basement over there.
All right. Well, people, check it out.
Look forward to seeing it. You come get a picture with me as long as you promise not to cry.
All right. I won't do that. All right. Thank you.
Right.
And I won't pee on your lap either. So there
thank
you go.
All that right. happens.
I know it does. All right, Chuck. Take care.
Okay.
Bye. Chuck's our good old Santa Claus guy, and that's a real beard. Not fake. Not one of these fake beard Santas. He's the real deal, man. All right, let's finish this up here. Will Smith was in the movie Where the Day Takes You. That was his first movie. He had already been loved for about a year in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but that was his feature film debut. Gina Davis is in Tootsie. And her first appearance, she's just in teeny underwear. It's she works on the soap opera that Dustin Hoffman gets the job, and he shares like a dressing room with her. Halle Berry's first movie was Jungle Fever. Her first role was in the failed spinoff of Who's the Boss called Living Dolls. Living Dolls. She was going to be in Living Dolls, a spinoff of Who's the Boss. But her film debut was in Spike Lee's story about an interracial couple in 1990s New York. She's great in Jungle Fever. Like, really great. She plays Vivian, or Viv, Gator Purify, that would be Samuel L. Jackson's girlfriend. Watch her hold her own in a yelling match when Gator asks her to leave. And then also making their debut in Jungle Fever was Queen Latifah. She played a waitress in that one, but she was already really well known as a rap star at that point. So, all right, there you go. There are some of the first roles, and I want to see Grizzly 2, the concert, and Frankenstein and Me. Those are the takeaways that I got from this one. All right, we got a break here for the news, and then after the news, NBA regular season has kicked off, and we'll inform you about all the names of the teams and how they got them. That's coming up after the news, which is next. Doc requesting Junior Brown ain't going to work today. All right, that's it. That should be everybody's motto. Welcome back, everybody. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, baby, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. We do it every Thursday, 312-981-7200. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 o'clock, and Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5, and the outstanding and awesome, my main man, Steve Cochran, star of Grumpy Old Men, will be in at 6 o'clock for your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we're back. So the NBA season has started, and the Bulls start their regular season. And so we thought we would talk about the origins of all of the NBA teams, their names. And these are always a lot of fun. We did this before, and how many of these are contests, I wonder? Because
a lot.
We discovered that they were like, that. How are we going to get the name? Let's throw a contest out there. But so we've got the stories, the origins of the NBA team names, and you can enjoy your NBA.
I think the real gem of this article, as we're about to find out, are the names they didn't choose.
Yeah.
Because there are some choice ones.
Yeah. That's always a lot of fun when you find out what a certain professional team could have been. Let's start with the Atlanta Hawks. In 1948, the cities of Moline and Rock Island, Illinois, and Davenport, Iowa, collectively known as the Tri-Cities at the time, were awarded a team in the National Basketball League. The team was nicknamed the Blackhawks, who, like Chicago's hockey team, were named after the Sauk Indian chief Black Hawk. When the team moved to Milwaukee in 1951, the nickname was shortened to Hawks. The franchise retained the shortened moniker for subsequent moves to St. Louis and then finally Atlanta in 1968. So that's where it came from. Boston Celtics. Here's a question. Why is it Celtics? You know what I mean? Because it should be Celtics. That's always made me a little crazy. Because the word is Celtic. Don't you think, Dan? Would this drive your wife nuts?
That is a good question. I'm afraid to bring it up.
The Celtics team owner Walter Brown personally chose Celtics over Whirlwinds, Olympians, and unicorns as the nickname for Boston's Basketball Association of America team in 1946. That's despite the warnings of one of the publicity staffers who told Brown, quote, "No team with an Irish name has ever won a thing in Boston." Are they not aware of the Irish population that's in Boston? You know? It's a big population of Irish people there.
According to Mental Floss?
Yeah.
Celtic is the proper pronunciation.
Oh, it is?
It is, but Celtic, because Celtic is the outlier. But the tribes that were about saying it as Celtic just were adamant about it, and that's how it got eventually included into Exelon. But in general, this author who grew up in the west of Ireland notes that Celtic is the much more common.
Is that right?
Yeah, because he goes... nearly every other English word beginning with CE has a soft C sound. Cedar, ceiling, cell, cement, scent, cereal, certain, cesspit, and so on and so forth.
Wow. Okay. Well, I didn't know that. I thought the Celtics.
It would have been the other way around.
Yeah, I thought it was the other way around.
If you asked me, I would have said Celtic before Celtic.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. Okay. See, we're learning something here. You don't say this isn't an educational program. We learned about Frankenstein and me, and now we learn that Celtic is indeed the correct way to pronounce Celtic. Okay, the Brooklyn Nets. The New Jersey Americans joined the American Basketball Association in 1967, moved to New York the following season. The team was renamed the New York Nets, which conveniently rhymed with Jets and Mets. So they just wanted to have rhyming team names. That's pretty funny. In 1994, the Nets were reportedly considering changing their nickname to the Swamp Dragons to boost its marketing efforts. The franchise relocated to Brooklyn in 2012. The Swamp Dragons? How is that an appropriate name for a basketball team? And how many dragons and swamps are in New York? Are there a lot of dragons and swamps that I'm not aware of? We might be discovering that there are dragons in swamps in New York and snakes falling out of the sky in the ceilings. Okay, swamp dragons. That would be hilarious if they were called the swamp dragons. How about the Charlotte Hornets? Where did Hornets come from? In 1987, George Shin and his ownership group decided to sponsor a Name the Team contest and had fans vote on six finalists. More than 9,000 ballots were cast, and Hornets won by a landslide, beating out Knights, Cougars, Spirit, Crowns, and Stars. Afterwards, Shin noted that the nickname had some historical significance. During the Revolutionary War, a British commander reportedly referred to the area around Charlotte as a hornet's nest of rebellion. Oh, that's cool. All right, here we go. Chicago Bulls, everybody. According to the Chicago Bulls Encyclopedia, there's a Chicago Bulls Encyclopedia? Really? So according to the Chicago Bulls Encyclopedia, team owner Richard Klein was brainstorming nicknames for his new franchise in 1966 and wanted to name that portrayed Chicago's status as the meat capital of the world. Another theory, though, is that Klein admired the strength and toughness of bulls. Klein was considering matadors and toreadors when his young son exclaimed, "Dad, that's a bunch of bull!" And the rest of is somewhat dubious history. That's pretty funny. Dad, that's a bunch of bull. The Chicago Toreadors? What is that? Or matadors? That's ridiculous. But yeah, man, we're the meat capital of the world. I like living in the city that's the meat capital of the world. So, Cleveland Cavaliers. Jerry Tomko, who suggested Cavaliers in the contest, wrote, "Cavaliers represent a group of daring, fearless men whose life pact was never surrender, no matter what the odds." Huh. Okay. All right. You want to know where nicknames came from? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We got more of the NBA nicknames or team names to talk about. 312-981-7200. Here's the forecast from the Chicago WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, a frosty morning gives way to sunny skies and a high near 56. For tonight, cloudy, breezy, not as cold, low around 44. Tomorrow, showers, high near 61. Saturday, partly cloudy and a high of 52. And then Sunday, sunny and a high near 50. It's currently 37 degrees at O'Hare. It's 38 at Midway, 43 at the lakefront. All right, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk more about how teams got their names and their nicknames. And if you want to jump in with any comments or questions or any of that kind of stuff, talk or text 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are back, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah! Doc requesting Junior Brown. That's the Surf Medley instrumental. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We've been talking about the NBA, how their teams got their names. And Dan, we wanted to go back to the Celtics thing again?
Yeah, a caller explained to me that I misread the article. The Celtic is the proper pronunciation from Ireland. So when people started seeing it in America, and because all of the English words had the soft C like cedar or, you know, along those lines, that's why they started calling it Celtic, even though it should be Celtic.
Right. Okay, so we were right the first time, and it's those damn Americans. That's the problem. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Did they have a contest, Dan, for the Chicago Dogs, I wonder?
That's a good question. I doubt it. I mean, that seemed like a pretty obvious one.
It was funny, you know, because that's the baseball team that plays in Rosemont. And so, when I heard the Chicago Dogs, I thought that the logo was going to be a dog, you know, like a canine. The logo's a hot dog. And and of course, that makes sense, you know, but I don't know if I've ever seen. And isn't the Texas team called the T-Bones? And it's like a steak. Their logo is like a steak. So the logo for the Chicago Dogs in this league is a hot dog. And the mascot is a hot dog dude. The dude is a hot dog. That's their mascot. But I don't know if they had like a if they had like a contest.
Yeah, it doesn't list one on the website.
No. All right. Let's see what else we've got here. The Dallas Mavericks. Here's another one of these. A Dallas radio station sponsored a Name the Team contest and recommended the finalists to team owner Donald Carter, who ultimately chose Mavericks over Wranglers or Express. The 41 fans who suggested Mavericks each won a pair of tickets to the season opener, and one of those fans, Carla Springer, won a drawing for season tickets. Springer, a freelance writer, said the nickname represents the independent, flamboyant style of the Dallas people. I think Wranglers would have worked, though, right?
Yep.
The Dallas Wranglers, the Daleks Express, those are both not bad. Those are both pretty good names.
Remember the Dave Kaplan Dallas Maverick thing?
No. Does it involve the negotiator?
He wishes. If I remember this correctly, I was young when this happened, but if I believe Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, was on John Williams' show, or a show that was on in the afternoon when Kaplan was doing sports.
Yeah.
And
okay.
He told Kaplan that if he changed his name to Dallas Maverick for a year, he'd give him like $10,000 or something.
Right. I remember. That's true. No, that's a true story. Now I remember it. All right. Let's see. So that's the Dallas Mavericks.
If he had asked him to change it to the negotiator, he would have done
that. He would have done that, yes. If Dave Kaplan was asked to change his name to the negotiator. A little history on this for people who don't know. The negotiator came out, 97, 98 maybe? Right around that time?
98,
okay. And so, you know, when Dave was working here, I would, you know, we'd come across each other in the hallway, or sometimes like I would follow a sports show or something. And Dave, you know, obviously I review movies, and so Dave would always, you know, we'd ask about movies. What movies did you like? What do you like here? And blah, blah, blah. And he went nuts over The Negotiator. This was the Kevin Spacey, Samuel Jackson. Paul Giamatti's in that movie, too, if I'm not mistaken. And so I'm not crazy about the movie. I don't like it very much. I was never really crazy about it. And it's like his favorite movie. And there, you know, any time I would see Dave after that movie came out, we would talk maybe about a different movie, and then he would always go, "The Negotiator." Phenomenal.
Flat out phenomenal.
Flat out phenomenal. The Negotiator. And this went on for years. You know, like this, it's like, I mean, this movie, I mean, The Negotiator was a solid hit, but, you know, you have to, some people, most people go, "Negotiator, who's in that again?" You know, it's not immediately recognizable. Like, you remember who's in it, you remember, it's a classic movie. It's one of those movies where you go, oh, yeah, that's right. That was that Kevin Spacey movie. That's right. But he was like Negotiator. Flat out phenomenal.
Got your guy J.T. Walsh in there, too.
That's right. J.T. Walsh is in that movie. But, yeah, I mean, it wouldn't matter what we were talking about. We were talking about any other movie for years past. He would always go back to The Negotiator. Because he would go, "I don't trust you because you don't like The Negotiator." Which is flat out phenomenal. That was
Al.
That was always brought up too, man.
I remember riding with you in the elevator, and I'm like, it was the first time I think I was in an elevator with the two of you. I'm like, I wonder if this is going to happen, and it did.
And it did. No, I'm not kidding when I say. I mean, up until before he left the station, it was a constant thing. And like I said, Negotiator came out 20 years ago. And Dave has been gone. How long has Dave been gone? About 3 years?
Maybe a little more than that, but yeah.
Yeah, something like that, right around there. And it was all the way, it was something. And if I see him, if I ever see him, I didn't come to the ceremony because he was inducted in the Walk of Fame this year. I didn't come to the ceremony. But I guarantee you, if I had come to the ceremony and I saw Dave, he'd go, "You know, Negotiator should get a star on the Walk of Fame." Because it's flat out phenomenal. it just came up every single time. So, all right. How about the Denver Nuggets? Denver's ABA team was originally known as the Rockets. When the team was preparing to move to the NBA in 1974, they needed a new nickname, as Rockets was already claimed by the franchise in Houston. Nuggets, an allusion to the city's mining tradition and the Colorado Gold Rush during the late 1850s and early 1860s, was chosen via a Name the Team contest. Dan, have you ever participated in a Name the Team contest?
I apparently am one of the few who haven't.
I haven't either. Now, how is that possible, considering that everybody on the planet besides you and I have participated in a Name the Team contest? That's why I was wondering if they had one for the dogs. This one makes sense. Detroit Pistons. That totally makes sense. The Pistons trace their roots to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where they were known as the Zollner Pistons. What's a Zollner Piston? A piston manufactured by the then team owner, Fred Zollner, who named the club after his personal business. When the team moved to Detroit in 1957, Zollner dropped his name from the nickname but retained Pistons. The name was fitting for the Motor City. That's interesting that they were the Pistons before...
Right, before Detroit.
Before Detroit. That's really crazy. All right. Let's break here, everybody. We got the news coming up and then more team names and how they got them. And we'll talk more about the Negotiator, just in case Dave's listening. Doc requesting Junior Brown Highway Patrol, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah! So, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich will be in at 5 with the opening bell. The great Steve Cochran at 6. Yeah. Hey, by the way, I do want to mention when we get back to the NBA teams and how they got their names. If you want to jump in with talk or text questions or comments, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. I do want to mention my next film club screening is our tribute to the late great Burt Reynolds. We're showing one of his best movies ever, The Longest Yard, that great prison football movie, very entertaining, great crowd pleaser. And it very, very rarely gets shown. Very rarely gets shown on cable. And very, very rarely gets shown in movies. And we've got the 4K digital restoration that we are going to show in the big, beautiful premiere theater at the AMC Rosemont 18. And it's going to be on Tuesday, November 13th. Tuesday's November 13th, The Longest Yard, the original. Burt Reynolds, a bunch of amazing character actors. It's really one of his best and most entertaining movies, and we're thrilled that we're going to be showing it to remember Burt Reynolds. So it's on Tuesday, November 13th, and it's going to be at the AMC Rosemont 18, and you can get your tickets now at amctheaters.com. That's amctheaters.com. And it's only $10. Parking is free. It's going to be great. So the movie starts at 8. Show up a little bit early. You grab some really cool food at the concession stand. Have it in the dining room. You can go upstairs where the theater is. There's a full bar if you want to have some drinks. And at 8 o'clock, we'll all go into the theater. And then I'll introduce the movie. And then we'll all watch The Longest Yard together in the beautiful theater with the big love seats and great projection and sound. And then afterwards, we'll talk about it, and I'll give you some behind-the-scenes stories and some trivia and some stuff like that. And then we'll talk, do a little Q&A as well. So come on out. We're honoring the great Burt Reynolds with one of his best movies ever, the original The Longest Yard from 1974. A fantastic movie. And it's really great to see that movie with a crowd. You very rarely get a chance to see the original Longest Yard with an audience, and it's just such a great crowd-pleasing movie. So come on out Tuesday, November 13th at the AMC Rosemont 18 for our screening of The Longest Yard. And it's $10. Parking is free. Get your tickets now. Reserve your seats now so they'll be waiting for you. And that is amctheaters.com. amctheaters.com. All right. Cool. Okay. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And we've been telling you about how the NBA chose the names and the nicknames of their teams. But let's see. We got Brian here on WGN. Hey, Brian.
Since we're having more Negotiator talk, I was an extra in the movie, and I played a Chicago cop, and it was like the opening hostage scene.
Yeah.
And it was cool to be on the first time I was ever in a movie as an extra, but during like the downtime, I was walking around Chicago right by the Aragon Ballroom is where they filmed the movie. And I went into one of the stores to get something to drink, and there was a bum in there giving the owner a hard time. And he says, "Hey, officer, can you kick this guy out of here. I said, no, I'm not a cop, but I play one in a movie. I said, I'm an extra. I got a rubber gun and everything. I said, I can't do nothing about that. He was like, all right, well, can you take him out of here? You look like a big guy. I'm like, no, I'm not going to.
Wow.
And it was neat being on set of the negotiator. I saw Sam Jackson, and just it was deep when the sniper took the shot and blew the window out. It was really
right.
Deep. So.
Right.
But what was upsetting is I was in a bunch of other scenes, and I told everybody I knew, dude, I'm going to be in this movie, and they cut them all out. I was so mad.
They cut them all out. Yeah, that's great, though. But that's a great story. Oh. You're walking around in Uptown dressed like a cop. That's...
Yeah, it was pretty neat. It was kind of empowering. I was like, but one thing I always do, my dad said, don't ever pretend to be a Chicago cop. I was like, I don't even want to go there.
No, that's not a good thing. All right, Brian, great story.
Bad things.
Great story. Thanks for the call. Okay, take care. All right.
Bye.
All right, 312-981-7200. That's great. That's a great story, right, Dan?
That is fantastic.
I don't know if I would walk around Uptown dressed as a cop, though. That would not be something that I would, you know. Oh, man. All right. Let's see. Let's get back to some of these NBA team names. The Golden State Warriors. The Philadelphia Warriors, named after the 1920s team that played in the American Basketball League, won the championship in the inaugural 1946-47 season of the Basketball Association of America. The Warriors eventually relocated to California, where they were renamed the Golden State Warriors. And they from then on they won every year. they made postseason basketball boring. The Houston Rockets. Well, this seems like an obvious one to me as well. Maybe we can
just it's like the Pistons though. It's crazy.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we can ask Rod about this tomorrow. The Houston Rockets originally called San Diego home. Rockets was chosen via Name the Team contest and was a reference to the city's theme, A City in Motion. Liquid-fueled Atlas Rockets were also being manufactured in San Diego. When the team moved to Houston in 1971, it made perfectly good sense to keep the name, as Houston is the home of NASA's Space Center. That's crazy. So the Pistons were the Pistons before Detroit, and the Rockets were the Rockets before Houston. That's just weird, man. All right. The Indiana Pacers. The nickname is a reference to Indiana's rich harness and auto racing history. Pacing describes one of the main gates for harness racing, while pace cars are used for auto races, such as the Indianapolis 500. All right. That makes sense. The Los Angeles Clippers. When the NBA's Buffalo Braves, I'm sorry, I went right to hockey. Without even thinking, I just immediately went there. The NBA's Buffalo Braves moved to San Diego in 1978. The owners wanted to rebrand the team with a new nickname. They settled on Clippers, a popular type of ship during the 19th century. San Diego had been home to the Conquistadors, sales, and of the ABA during the 70s. All right. The Los Angeles Lakers. This is another one that doesn't make any sense at all. When a pair of investors relocated the Detroit Gems, of the National Basketball League to Minneapolis before the 1947 season, they sought a name that would ring true to the team's new home. Given that Minnesota is the land of 10,000 lakes, they settled on Lakers. When the Lakers moved to Los Angeles before the 1960 season, their nickname was retained, in part because of the tradition the team had established in Minnesota. Okay, that's like, I can't wait till we get to the Utah Jazz. That's a... Because, you know, when you think Jazz, you think Utah.
Yep.
Well, you think Lakes... You think L.A. The Memphis Grizzlies. When Vancouver was awarded an expansion team franchise in 1994 to begin the following season, the team's owners had tentative plans to name them the Mounties. The Royal Mounted Canadian Police and fans alike objected. So team officials resumed with their search for a name. The local newspaper spotted yet again something that Dan and I are the only two people who've never participated in, a Name the Team contest, which club officials monitored for choosing grizzlies, an indigenous species to the area, over ravens. So when the team relocated to Memphis before the 2001-2002 season, FedEx was offered was prepared to offer the Grizzlies $100 million to rename the team the Express, but the NBA rejected the proposal. And again, Memphis, when you think Grizzlies, you think, well, when I think Grizzlies now, I think George Clooney.
In concert.
Yes.
I'd like to think that the Mounties were very polite in their displeasure with them being, you know.
Sorry,
this isn't going to fly, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, they were very, very polite. Very, very polite in saying, I don't think you should call it the Mounties. Let's see. The Miami Heat. In October 1986, the owners of Miami's expansion franchise selected Stephanie Freed's Heat submission for more than 20,000 entries. Again, name that team. Some of the names included Sharks, Beaches, and Barracudas. Beaches? The Miami Beaches? And the team's theme song would be Wind Beneath My Wings? Would that be what was going on there? Who the hell would pick Beaches? The Miami Beaches. I mean, obviously, there are beaches in Miami. The Heat's a weird name, too. I've always thought that the Miami Heat was a weird name. I mean, it's hot in Miami, okay? I understand that. So, anyway. Oh, man. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And here's a question for you if you want to jump in here with the talk or text. Have you ever participated in a Name the Team contest? Because evidently it's an incredibly popular thing. So, yeah. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's break here for a second for the weather. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How are you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio on the 18th floor here on Wacker Drive, overlooking a beautiful downtown Chicago on a Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday ends right here. Yeah. And we'll do it again next week. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Steve Grzanich coming up at 5 with the opening bell. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Okay, we've been telling you how the NBA teams got their names, and we've also put out the question, have you ever participated in a Name the Team contest? Because it seems to be a wildly popular thing that's happened, and everybody seems to have participated. I have not, and neither has Dan. But so many of these stories of the origins of these names for teams involves a fantastic little contest. So... We've just finished up with how the Miami Heat got their name. Luckily, they could have been called the Miami Beaches. If that that would have won the contest, we'd be talking about the Miami Beaches right now.
630 texted in that he or she entered a contest for the Schaumburg Boomers baseball name.
Schaumburg Boomers.
Boomers.
Did they vote for Boomers? I don't know. That's a pretty good name for a baseball team, Boomers. All right. How about this? The Milwaukee Bucks, despite Wisconsin's hunting tradition, the most popular entry in the contest to name the Milwaukee's NBA franchise wasn't Bucks. It was Robins. The judges overruled the public and decided on the more indigenous and much stronger name. The choice could have been worse. Skunks was among the other entries. The Milwaukee Robins. I don't know. That's not a very, threatening name. We're going to play the Robins. So, and the other thing, the Skunks, the Milwaukee Skunks. Wow. Right. How about this? The Minnesota Timberwolves. The ownership group for Minnesota's prospective franchise chose Timberwolves through a Name the Team contest in 1986. The nickname beat out Pollers by a 2-1 margin in the final vote. The Pollers, Minnesota Pollers. All right. Here's a good one. New Orleans Pelicans. Soon after Tom Benson purchased the New Orleans Hornets in 2012, the team announced that they were going to change their name. According to Yahoo's Mark J. Spears, they considered the nicknames Crew, groups of costume paraders in the annual Mardi Gras carnival in New Orleans, and Brass, but they settled on Pelicans. After the Brown Pelican, which is Louisiana's state bird. Okay. And, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, the mascot for the Pelicans is terrifying. It's the mascot for the Pelicans? Is that the baby?
No.
No, the mascot for the Pelicans is a pelican.
Right. Right. Or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember.
But they consider, like, they did that for Mardi Gras. Pierre the Pelican.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Here is Francis on WGN. Hi, Francis.
Hi, how you guys doing this morning?
All right, what do you got?
The first time I heard the Cavaliers was back in 1962 when my father and his friend decided to start a Little League team, which grew to a Little League, Pony League, and Connie Mack. And they were called the Cavaliers, and the reason they were called that, he said, was for the same reason that the Cavaliers have named themselves that. And like I told the guy when he answered the phone, first they were called the Cavaloosers because they lost all the time. But then they started winning, and everybody wanted to beat the Cavaliers. So that's a shout-out to the Cavaliers from Tulley Park on the south side.
There you go. All right, Francis, thanks for the call.
All right, bye-bye.
There you go. The Cavaloosers. Oh, man. All right. How about the New York Knicks? The term knickerbockers referred specifically to pants rolled up just below the knee by Dutch settlers in the New World during the 1600s. Team founder Ned Irish reportedly made the decision to call the team the Knickerbockers, supposedly after pulling a name out of a hat. No kidding. Does anybody refer to them as the Knickerbockers?
People are trying to be cool.
Yeah. Do they have any merch that says Knickerbockers?
I don't think so. Not officially.
Because it's always Knicks. That's funny. Because, you know, the Mets is a shortened version, too. There are no Metropolitans. Do they have any New York Metropolitans merch? And does anybody refer to the Mets as the Metropolitans? How about the Oklahoma City Thunder? When the Seattle Supersonics relocated to Oklahoma City after the 2007-08 season, fans voted for potential nicknames from an original list of 64 possibilities. Thunder was chosen over Renegades, Twisters, and Barons, and the name was extremely well-received. The Supersonics had been named for the Supersonic Transport Project, which had been awarded to Boeing. The company has a large plant in the Seattle area. And then the Orlando Magic. When Orlando Sentinel sponsored a Name the Team contest for Orlando's prospective expansion franchise, entries included Floridians, Juice... Juice? Because of orange juice? The Orlando Juice. Orbits, Astronauts, Aquaman? And the Sentinels. A panel of judges, including Orlando's team officials who reviewed suggestions, decided to go with Magic. The name was an obvious nod to the tourism-rich city's main attraction, the Disney World. I would have gone with Juice. For sure. The Philadelphia 76ers, well, this has got to be an obvious one. Come on. The Syracuse Nationals were located in the city of brotherly love in 1963, and the team was renamed the 76ers, which was an allusion to the signing of the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia in 1776, of course. Phoenix Suns. General manager Jerry Colangelo, only 28 at the time, settled on a name for his expansion franchise using a Name the Team contest in 1968. It included such obscure entries as White Wing Doves. Is that a Stevie Nicks tribute? What the hell? What is that? Sun Lovers, Poobahs, Dudes, and Cactus Giants. That's fantastic. Poobahs and Dudes. Portland Trailblazers. In 1970, Portland was granted an expansion franchise in the NBA, and team officials announced a name the team contest. Every one of them. More than 10,000 entries. Pioneers was the most popular, but it was ruled out because nearby Lewis and Clark College was already using that nickname. The Sacramento Kings. The Kings' royal lineage stretches back all the way back to the founding of the National Basketball League's Rochester Royals in 45. The Royals retained their nickname when they moved to Cincinnati in 57 and became the Kansas City Omaha Kings. And then they were renamed. It was unchanged when they moved to California. The San Antonio Spurs, after receiving their first decision to call the team the Aztecs, several teams already had that name, judges in the naming contest settled on the Spurs. The Toronto Raptors, my favorite. That's my favorite. The ownership group of Toronto's prospective expansion team conducted an extensive research in Canada in 1994. Raptors, which Jurassic Park helped popularize the year before, was eventually chosen over the runner-up of the Bobcats and the Dragons. Utah Jazz, here it is. The team originated in New Orleans in 1974. The club officials decided to keep the name when relocating to Salt Lake City. And then finally, the Washington Wizards in early 1990s. Washington Bullets owner Abe Pollin had become frustrated with the association of the team's nickname and gun violence. After Pollin's friend, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, said that when he was assassinated, Pollin decided to take action and announce his plans to change the team to the Wizards. So there you go. Everything you needed to know about the names of NBA teams. All right, we're going to take a break. The news is coming up next, and we'll tell you what's on the show tomorrow right after this.